sound of deliciousness.
The Fibre Factor with me, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, from BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of February. This is Today with Justin Webb and Johnny Diamond.
The headlines this morning: Downing Street has responded to Conservative pressure to release information about Lord Bandelson's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US by saying it is willing to publish some documents at some point. It's emerged that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor left his home in Windsor on Monday evening to move to Norfolk. And a new 10-year cancer plan for England will set updated targets for the NHS, but experts say more investment will be needed.
Also in today's programme, the man Donald Trump charged with securing peace in Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg, tells us why he thinks Russia will fail to win on the battlefield.
What Putin is trying to do, he's trying to break the will of Ukrainians. My experience from being in Kyiv, from being in Kharkiv, that's not going to work.
And after 45 years, they're back.
Isn't it wonderful being back in the theatre and giving the people what they truly want?
Moi. Can't believe they're doing the old show again.
Well, if it ain't broke.
No, they are broke. That's why they're doing it.
But why is The Muppet Show returning now? We'll hear from one of the original puppeteers. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The government says it will release some documents relating to its decision to appoint Lord Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to Washington after further revelations about his links to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Their publication isn't expected to happen immediately. The Conservatives have been pushing for more details about the vetting process, which saw the former Labour minister appointed to the role this time last year before being sacked in September. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
These documents concern Sir Keir Starmer's decision to resurrect Peter Mandelson's career and send him to Washington. The Conservatives have tabled a rare parliamentary motion known as a humble address to try to force the release of information. They want all papers relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment published, details of his vetting for the role, and communications between him and officials, including the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. Such is the anger at Peter Mandelson, it was clear that many Labour MPs would not have been willing to oppose the Tory motion had the government tried to vote it down. Instead, the Prime Minister has amended it, agreeing to publish the documents apart from those deemed prejudicial to national security or international relations. As for Lord Mandelson, he will now face questioning from Scotland Yard as part of an investigation into allegations of misconduct in public office. He has not commented publicly on the latest developments, but is understood to believe he did not act criminally, nor did he act to gain personally, and he will cooperate with the police.
BBC News understands that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has moved from his home in Windsor to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk. Buckingham Palace announced last October that he would no longer be allowed to live at Royal Lodge following revelations then linked to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was last seen in public on Monday. He was pictured on a horse ride close to his former home in Windsor, and was then seen driving from the castle, waving at passers-by. We now know that on Monday evening, as further revelations emerged around his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, he left Windsor for good and made the move to his new base on the Sandringham estate. His permanent home will be Marsh Farm, but that property is currently undergoing renovations, so he'll stay temporarily at Wood Farm, a property previously used by his father, Prince Philip.
Thames Valley Police says it's assessing information after the BBC reported allegations by a second woman that she was sent to the UK by Jeffrey Epstein in 2010 for a sexual encounter with the then Prince Andrew. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor hasn't responded to this claim and has always strongly denied any wrongdoing. Ministers are promising that far more patients diagnosed with cancer will survive for 5 years or longer by 2035. The pledge is included in a new 10-year cancer plan for the NHS in England. Charities have welcomed the government's ambitions, but some experts have expressed doubt about whether the targets are realistic. More from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A key cancer target in England is that 85% of patients should begin their treatment within 62 days of an urgent referral, but this hasn't been met since 2014. Currently, 70% hit that goal. Ministers say this will now be achieved by March 2029, along with two other targets, one covering rapid diagnosis. The government says around 60% of patients currently survive 5 years or more, a lower rate than in Poland and Romania for some cancers. The aim is to get this to 75% by 2035. The plan proposes investing more in scanners and digital technology to speed up diagnosis and more robot-assisted surgery. Cancer Research UK said this was a significant commitment. The Nuffield Trust think tank said the ambition was welcome, but the NHS would find the targets incredibly difficult to meet based on current performance.
Ukraine and Russia are to resume peace talks in Abu Dhabi under the auspices of the US. Yesterday, President Zelensky said Russian airstrikes on the Ukrainian energy network showed Moscow was choosing terror over diplomacy. A review has recommended creating a new post at the heart of government to oversee criminal courts in England and Wales. The retired judge, Sir Brian Leveson, was asked by ministers to look at ways of reducing the unprecedented backlog of cases. Here's Dominic Casciani.
Sir Brian says his recommendations mustn't lead to a pick-and-mix job, and ministers, the police, judges and others must all act quickly. He wants a dedicated advisor answerable to the Prime Minister to oversee efficiency reforms across the fragmented justice system and more use of artificial intelligence tools to help prepare cases more quickly and judges to better schedule trials. The Law Society, which represents criminal solicitors, says the report underlines the need for more funding across the courts. Ministers are expected to respond to the proposals within weeks.
Rules are to be changed to make it easier for more people to become foster carers in England. The new approach is part of the government's plans to create 10,000 more places for children by 2029. Our social affairs editor Alison Holt reports.
Two-thirds of the more than 80,000 children currently in local authority care in England live with foster families. However, in the past 5 years, the number of foster carers has fallen by 12% to just over 56,000. It means more children end up in residential care. The government says its plans to modernise the system will speed up decision-making and make it easier for single people, working families and those from diverse backgrounds to foster. It promises more support, including help with extending homes to create the space to take children in. £88 million is being put in to help fund the changes, but the government says having fewer children in costly residential homes will be better for the children and also free up council budgets.
That was our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
Thank you for that. To the weather then at 8 minutes past six with Darren Bett. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Justin. It shouldn't be feeling quite so cold for us today. There will be a southeasterly breeze picking up eventually, but we've got some wet weather moving very slowly northwards today, mainly across northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Mostly rain, but there'll be some snow over the hills of northern England, and perhaps to some lower levels for a while this morning in Scotland. Here the snow will tend to lift higher up onto the hills and mountains, but it will stay damp probably through much of the day in Scotland as well. Temperatures here will be around 4 or 5 degrees at best. For Northern England and Northern Ireland, the wet weather will move its way northward, so it should become dry through the morning and into the afternoon, but it's likely to stay cloudy and temperatures will reach 7 degrees. We've got milder air though coming in to more southern parts of England and Wales, but here it's a very misty start to the day with some dense patches of fog. Those will tend to lift. Gradually the cloud will break up a little to allow some places to see a bit of sunshine heading into the afternoon, and it will be milder, temperatures here reaching 10 or 11 degrees. The southeasterly breeze will tend to become a bit stronger overnight tonight, so any mist and fog is more likely to be over the hills. It should be a frost-free night tonight. There'll be a bit of snow over the Grampians, but we're going to find some rain coming into southern parts of England and South Wales. That'll work its way steadily northwards tomorrow with some snow over the hills across northern parts the UK once again as it gets a bit colder and as that wind starts to pick up as well.
Thanks, Darren. It is 9 minutes past six. Time for a quick look at the morning's papers. All of them lead on Lord Mandelson becoming the subject of a criminal investigation. The Times says he's expected to be interviewed under caution after being accused of passing market-sensitive information to Jeffrey Epstein. The Daily Telegraph says the announcement means other senior figures from the New Labour era could also be questioned. The Guardian reports that detectives are also looking to request access to Lord Mandelson's devices. He hasn't responded to requests for comment about the allegations.
Most of the papers also reflect on Peter Mandelson stepping down from the Lords. Good riddance, says the Daily Star. The Eye's political editor, Hugo Jai, says there is no way back into public life now for the former Labour minister. The Daily Mirror highlights number 10, saying it's asked officials to draft legislation to strip the New Labour architect of his title, which, of course, he currently retains.
But The Guardian argues that for Downing Street, Lord Mandelson risks being a headache that simply won't end as the focus shifts to how he was given the role of Britain's ambassador to the US last year. The Daily Telegraph says the issue is threatening to undermine Sir Keir Starmer's leadership.
The Sun has more details on Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor moving out of Royal Lodge after new revelations about his ties to Epstein. The paper says it happened under the cover of darkness. He's also said to have been booted out earlier than planned. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has always, of course, denied any wrongdoing.
The Daily Express focuses on Prince Edward, the brother of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, urging people to remember the victims of Epstein. He made the comments at the World Governments Summit in Dubai after being asked by a reporter how he was coping with the fallout from the files.
And as filming gets underway for the Sir Sam Mendes Beatles movie, some of the papers carry photos of London being made to look like New York to recreate when the band appeared at the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. The Mail says it would be easy to believe that Beatlemania is still alive and kicking.
It is 11 minutes past six.
There are peace talks going on in Abu Dhabi today. Peace talks involving Ukraine and Russia, organised by the United States. But even as the two-day session begins, Ukraine is still facing massive attacks on its energy infrastructure. Let's talk to Sarah Rainsford, our correspondent in Kiev. Give us an update, Sarah.
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say that this is a very, very difficult environment for the peace talks to be taking place in, because although Donald Trump thought he'd done a deal with Vladimir Putin and that there would be a week-long pause in Russian strikes on the energy infrastructure here in Ukraine, that deal that he thought he had completely broke down on Monday night when there was a massive barrage of missiles and drones fired by Russia directly at the power plants here in Ukraine. So the situation with energy, again, is extremely difficult. And those power plants, which have been battered and attacked multiple times since last October, are now in a really dire state. And it means that people are struggling in many places to get power, to get heating, of course, right in the depths of winter. So that was supposed to be a kind of effort to de-escalate around the talks. And what Vladimir Zelensky has been saying as a result of that is, like, saying to the United States, look, Russia broke the deal completely. If Russia can't be trusted even to hold a truce for a few days, then how can you trust Russia to keep any deal they do around the talking table? But the talks are happening. They're going ahead. They will be, of course, extremely difficult. Vladimir Zelensky has said that Ukraine's ready for dialogue, but as he put it, not ready for surrender.
Is there any sense that you're getting that they would like not to be talking to Russia at the moment? In other words, that they're doing so because they feel they have to in order to keep Donald Trump on board?
I think there's certainly an element of that. Ukraine certainly needs to keep the US on board. It needs its intelligence. It needs, in particular, its air defense missiles, which it's now buying through a system with NATO and the EU. I should tell you that in the strike on Monday night, a very large number of missiles actually got through Ukraine's air defenses, much more than usual. And Ukraine has been saying very clearly that it really is struggling to keep its air defenses loaded and being able to shoot down those missiles. And that's why these attacks have been so particularly devastating. But in terms of the peace talks, you know, Ukraine does want peace. It does want to bring an end to this war. But the problem is, as far as Ukraine sees it, is that it's the only side that's under pressure to make any compromises. And those compromises are far too difficult for Ukraine at this point, even at this point, to make. So compromises on land in particular, it's being asked to hand over territory in the Donbass to Russia, even though Russia hasn't managed to win that on the battlefield. Russia, as far as we understand, isn't being asked to make any compromises at all. And of course, Ukraine's point is, you know, Russia launched this war, it hasn't stopped its aggression, and it clearly doesn't intend to do that. It wants Ukraine to surrender. So yes, it's taking part in those talks, partly because it wants to bring an end to the war. But yeah, I think there is a degree by which Ukraine isn't expecting anything to really come of this, unless there's pressure put on Russia as well as Ukraine.
Sarah Rainsford in Kiev, thank you.
14 minutes past six, and inquests into five babies whose deaths are linked to the nurse Lucy Letby, who's serving 15 whole life jail terms for murder and attempted murder. Those inquests into five babies' deaths in 2015 will open later today. They come as the Netflix documentary, The Investigation of Lucy Letby, which has already caused something of a stir, as that documentary is released today around the world. Judith Moritz is our special correspondent. There may be hullabaloo, Judith, good morning. There may be hullabaloo around the Netflix documentary, but the inquests will be the focus of today, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly for the families of those babies, five babies, inquests beginning today. And we, as you may remember from the coverage of the trial, are not able to identify them publicly because their names are protected by court order. But they'll be known as in court again as babies C, E, I, O and P. For context, these are five of the seven babies that Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering. The other two have already had either a full inquest or an inquest process beginning. And so what we're going to see today is the coroner will open the inquest into these five babies, but she will then quickly adjourn them and suspend them. And she's explained at a previous hearing that is because she's going to wait for the outcome of the public inquiry, the Thirlwall inquiry into the events at the Countess of Chester Hospital, into the Lucy Letby scandal. She is going to wait for that to publish its report, and that's expected later this year. So there will be a delay in the holding of full hearings for these inquests, but the opening will be today.
When they do resume and eventually conclude, what, if anything, will we learn from them?
Well, the point about these inquests is that when the babies first died in 2015 and 2016, circumstances as understood at that point were obviously very different. That was before the police had come along to begin an investigation. It was certainly before anybody had heard the name Lucy Letby connected with any of this. Now, since that point, and inquests were not held for those five babies because of the criminal proceedings put on pause. But since that point, there have been convictions. Lucy Letby convicted of their murder. Mm. That counts in the coroner's court, of course, as a material change to the original circumstances. And so what the coroner will essentially do when she opens the case today is she will, in relation to each baby, she'll set out what the original understanding of their deaths was at the time. And they were at the time thought to have died from natural causes. She will then set out the judge's sentencing remarks for each baby, so what has been understood through the criminal court as to have happened in connection with Lucy Letby, and she will suggest a suggested new cause of death for each baby, but she will only express it as a suggestion at this stage, pending those full hearings, which we think will happen later this year.
Judith, thank you for taking us through that. Judith Moritz, our special correspondent.
17 minutes past six. There is a new AI tool that can help automate things like legal services, and it has had quite the impact, it seems, on the value of some companies. Sean is here with that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Justin. Yeah, it has. So the AI company Anthropic, it owns Claude, which is a chatbot rival to ChatGPT, amongst other things. It's launched a tool that can help do traditional sales, marketing, legal work as well. And it has had quite the ripple effect. So here in the UK, one of the biggest companies on the FTSE 100, RELX, it owns LexisNexis, that provides legal data, amongst other things there. Its share price fall more than 14%. And around the world, we've seen tech, software, analytics companies, America, around Europe, seeing their values hit. I caught up with Ruth Fox-Blader about this, founder of investor Fox Capital in New York.
A lot of the gains in share price of tech at this point is quite circular. It's really about investment in infrastructure, meaning investment in compute power. So there's an assumption that generative AI is going to be used more and more by all sorts of companies. All sorts of companies are going to need to invest in models. They're going to need to invest in running models. They're going to need compute power. They're going to need data centers. And there's been an enormous amount of CapEx spending promised in those areas. If we see things like Anthropic, which is, you know, mainly an enterprise tool, being able to do quite a lot more than, you know, maybe we initially thought, then maybe there isn't so much of a need for all of that infrastructure investment that we've been anticipating coming along with this AI boom. Maybe the boom is going to be so efficient that actually it doesn't kind of create as much wealth as we thought it was going to for the tech sector. I think that what we have seen, you know, for a couple of years now is sentiment really shifting back and forth very wildly. And any hint that these efficiency gains are actually coming has a really, you know, profound impact on markets for a day or two. The sense that, you know, perhaps all companies are overvalued or, you know, the tech sector is overbought. You know, this sort of bubble talk has been in the ether. It's been in the atmosphere really since October of last year. It hasn't had a ton of staying power. And my assumption is that, you know, we are going to continue to bottom out whether or not, you know, how much we believe in AI, where we think the gains are going to come from. But this is, we're really seeing that sentiment around an unknown that we believe is going to be profoundly impactful on the economy and on jobs.
So how would you sum up, Ruth, the consequence of an AI company launching a tool that can automate some legal and sales work? Just as this specific thing this morning, what are the ripple effects of that?
I think that these tools are very powerful, extremely efficient, and they show that incumbent technology companies, despite enormous amounts of proprietary data and years of know-how, are probably at risk of disruption more than they have been in, you know, decades, I would say.
So that was Ruth Foxblader, founder of Investor Fox Capital. Laura Lambie with me this morning, Senior Investment Director at Rathbones. Morning to you, Laura.
Good morning, Sean.
Just interesting, well, hearing what Ruth had to say there, when we've been talking about this on Wake Up to Money, get it on BBC Sounds this morning, hearing from businesses that may have seen their share prices hit yesterday on the back of this, and hearing them make the case that, no, actually, these tools might well help us improve. Is that the pitch to investors like yourself now that companies need to make, that this technology won't take away from our business, we'll actually use it to grow even quicker?
I think investors are gaining knowledge, but trying to get their head around exactly what this means. So you have, you know, things like RELX, Experian, Sage and Pearson all falling back yesterday because of this threat from Anthropic. But on the other hand, in the same newspaper, you have Walmart reaching £1 trillion worth of market valuation because of its massive investment into AI, integrated shopping through Google Gemini and OpenAI, to allow purchasing through chat GPT. And that has attracted, you know, better sales, higher membership of their loyalty program. So it is a kind of, there will be winners and losers in this, but at the moment it's extremely difficult to tell long term who they will be.
Sticking on the supermarket theme, as you brought up Walmart, let's bring it back over here to our own Asda and Morrisons here, seemingly losing ground, continuing to lose ground to competitors when we get these latest numbers about the market share that they have of our big shops that we do every week, every month. Why continuing in that way?
I think Asda certainly is burdened with a lot of private equity debt, which has not helped matters. Tesco, very well-run company, is in the lead with 29% market share, followed by Sainsbury's. We've had inflation figures out for food, which shows it's still sticky. We've still got higher input costs for farmers and whatever, which is affecting things like bread and cereals and confectionery. A 4% rise in the 4 weeks for the start of the year. However, that is that's the lowest since April 2025. So we're beginning to see food inflation dampen down a bit, but it's still quite high for the consumer.
So when both Asda and Morrisons separately were bought out, and there was a lot of debt involved in the purchases of those two massive supermarkets. What lessons are being learnt by maybe not just in the supermarket world about how those businesses have performed since those buyouts?
I think possibly the leverage that was required to take over these companies has been more fraught because interest rates have stayed higher for longer. But also, you know, the management of these companies are also not quite as spot on as we've seen in Tesco and Sainsbury's. So well-managed companies with, you know, manageable amounts of debt find it far easier to perform than those who don't, basically.
Interesting. And something that will pop up on many of the shelves of these supermarkets around the country, whether it's Iron Brew, Fentimans, Frobisher's Juices, the Iron Brew have bought up those brands. So, the makers of Iron Brew anyway, AG Barr, £50 million takeover. So a smaller number than we might often talk about this time of the morning, but brands that very much resonate. What's it all about, Laura?
It's really interesting. And this, I think, continues the story of adults looking for premium non-alcoholic drinks. Iron Brew is their basic, not that you would probably call that a high-end drink. So they're trying to have a multi-layered strategy where they have things like Rubicon Boost, Funkin are their existing products, and they're looking at Fentimans and Frobishers to complement these. Interestingly, we were talking about debt. They've paid for these acquisitions with cash. So another well-run company with not too much debt.
Laura, thank you for your time this morning. Laura Lambie, Senior Investment Director at Rathbones. Disney have chosen Josh D'Amaro as its new Chief Executive. He's going to take over from the veteran Bob Iger in March. Now, D'Amaro currently is Chairman of Experiences at Disney. So a reminder of the importance to the business of parks, hotels and its cruises as well, alongside all those studio brands it has, Marvel, Pixar, and it's got the sport broadcasting giant ESPN under its watch as well. Pete Blank is a former resort operations manager at Disney's Port Orleans Resort in Florida. Pete, you'll know how Josh D'Amaro works. What will it be like having him at the top of the business?
Well, good morning, Sean. He's going to do a fantastic job. I can tell you that there is a tremendous amount of optimism, both from your Disney fanatics, as well as all of your theme park cast members and cruise line cast members. I don't think he has anybody who is upset. I believe that the board made it a unanimous pick. He just has a gravitas to him, a genuineness to him, and a love of Disney to him that really makes him a good choice.
And Pete, we've spent a lot of time in recent weeks, months, talking about your Warner Brothers Discovery and Netflix and Paramount, all about streaming platforms and the movies and the TV shows, which Disney has. But a real reminder that Disney has something else as well.
It is the theme parks and experiences that help to drive the economic engine that is the Walt Disney Company. And ever since I've worked there years ago up till now, if you have a bad film, if you spend too much on marketing, a lot of times that revenue is made up for by the growth and the revenue that comes in through the theme parks. $36 billion this past year in revenue, helping to drive the entire company. So Josh is a parks and experiences guy. He'll do fine in that area, and he will learn the other sides of the business very quick. He's had a great mentor in Bob Iger. I mean, you can't ask for a better mentor than that.
When you say he'll learn, I mean, people might think the chief executive of Disney might not be expecting them to learn on the job. And given the way the world of streaming and movies, making movies is going, that's quite a crucial thing to walk in on day one and be on top of.
He has been quoted in multiple articles talking about he does not mind saying, "I don't know." This is a guy that is humble. This is a man who knows to surround himself with smart people. And he says he does not have to be the smartest person in the room. He just has to know where to get the answers. And I think that's a very transparent and genuine person to put in charge of this multi-billion-dollar company.
And just finally, Pete, from what you know about, you know, what's going on at these resorts now, the wider US tourism industry, has he got a bit of a challenge given the fall in tourists to America that we've heard is happening in recent times?
He does. He does. But again, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And we, the Disney company has put approximately $60 billion into a 10-year plan to improve the parks, the cruise ships, the experiences. So no matter what the political climate is or what's happening, there's going to be investment there, which means people are going to want to come see the greatest new attraction or show or something that, that comes across there. And let me just say this really quick. He's got in his office a picture, five black and white pictures of Walt Disney in his office. And he knows that that's a huge responsibility to carry on Walt's legacy. He's connected to the product and the magic. He
it is, of course, the Walt Disney Company. We abbreviate to Disney a lot. Pete Blank, former Resorts Operations Manager in Florida, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, Sean. It is 29 minutes past six, which means it's time for Mike Williams of the Sport. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Johnny. Arsenal are into their first cup final for 6 years. They beat Chelsea 1-0 last night in the second leg of their League Cup semi-final. Ian Dennis was watching at the Emirates.
A compelling cup tie. Tactically, it was fascinating, and it also had jeopardy up until Kai Havertz won it with the only goal in the 97th minute as he rounded the goalkeeper with a cool finish. Before that, Chelsea applied pressure, but Arsenal's defence stood firm, and Kepa was only really tested in the first half by Fernandes. Chances throughout were at a premium for both sides, but Arsenal, who've lost their previous four semi-finals, have now ended their hoodoo, and the goal sparked wild celebrations.
Yes, there really was. Exultation at the Emirates at full-time last night. Here is Arsenal's Dutch defender, Julian Timber, on those joyous scenes at the end of the match.
I have to think really good if I want to think back about a moment like this, but I think this was the first time I felt it like this. You could feel it coming, you know, he goes around the goalkeeper, he knows the stadium's going to go crazy. I've had some crazy nights here at the Emirates, but this is definitely one of them because the goal was so late as well.
So Arsenal through to the League Cup final at Wembley next month, where they will face either Manchester City or Newcastle, who meet in the second leg of the other semi-final this evening at the Etihad. City leading that tie 2-0. You can hear it on 5 Live from 8 p.m. Elsewhere, defeat last night for the Scottish Premiership leaders.
Yet another corner kick. Outswinger, header, goal! St Mirren have the goal! It's Miguel Freckleton who runs to the corner flag! Celebrate! There could be a massive goal at the bottom and the top of the Premiership.
We've caused our problems ourselves, no more than that, to be honest. You know, we've got a good game to respond to. Obviously, anytime we've only lost three, that's our third defeat now in the league, and my response has always been good. No greater game to have that response. Hibs next Tuesday at Tynecastle.
Yes, the Edinburgh Derby next up for Derek McInnes, but plenty to ponder for the Hearts manager as his side missed the chance to go 9 points clear at the top last night after a 1-0 loss to St Mirren. For the third time in four matches, they also had a man sent off. It is only their third league defeat of the season, but Hearts' lead at the top could now be cut to 3 points later this evening when Celtic and Rangers both play. And in cricket, England won the third T20 against Sri Lanka yesterday to complete a 3-0 series whitewash. Sam Curran hit a career-best 58 before England successfully defended a target of 129 to win by 12 runs.
Yeah, really pleased. I guess different conditions today. Third time on the wicket, so it was a little bit challenging. But I think just very pleased with the way we managed to creep to a score that we thought was defendable. And it's just great to be back playing for England. So I'm extremely excited for the next couple of weeks. And fantastic series win for us.
That's Sam Curran. After England's victory yesterday, the T20 Cricket World Cup starts this weekend.
Mike, thank you. Here now is Nuala McGovern with a word about a new podcast.
The number of children with special educational needs is increasing. Too many parents are having to fight to get those needs met, and councils are spending money that they do not have. In a new BBC podcast from Woman's Hour, we explore government reform and bring together families, teachers, experts and decision makers to reimagine the system. That is Send in the Spotlight, presented by me, Nuala McGovern. Listen now on BBC Sounds with new episodes every Monday.
27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Johnny Diamond. Let's get a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Downing Street has said it's willing to release documents related to its appointment of Lord Mandelson as Britain's ambassador to the US last year after the Conservatives called on the government to clarify the vetting process. This follows revelations suggesting he shared sensitive data with Jeffrey Epstein in 2009 while serving as a senior minister in Gordon Brown's cabinet. The Metropolitan Police is investigating the allegations. It's understood that Lord Mandelson believes he had not acted criminally. It emerged that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has moved out of Windsor to the Sandringham estate. He's understood to have left on Monday night. Thames Valley Police is assessing allegations that a second woman was sent to the UK by Jeffrey Epstein for a sexual encounter with the former prince at the Windsor estate in 2010. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has previously strongly denied wrongdoing. The government has pledged to diagnose and treat cancer faster in England as part of its 10-year plan to increase survival rates of the disease. The strategy doesn't include new funding towards cancer treatment. Delegates from Ukraine, Russia and the US are to meet in Abu Dhabi in more peace talks aimed at ending Moscow's war with Kyiv. Territory in eastern Ukraine remains a key sticking point in discussions to end the 4-year conflict. At least 14 migrants have died after their speedboat collided with a Greek patrol vessel in the Aegean. Children and a pregnant woman are among the injured taken to hospital. The collision happened off the island of Chios near Turkey. And rules on fostering are to be relaxed in England under plans to tackle a shortage of foster carers and create 10,000 more places. Under the proposals, people who rent, are single or unmarried, work full-time or come from diverse backgrounds will be allowed to open their homes to children in need of care.
Thank you for that. It is 25 to 7. The Conservatives want all the details of the vetting of Lord Mandelson carried out before he was appointed US ambassador to be made public. Let us talk to Henry Zethlin, the BBC's chief political correspondent, who is on the line. Are they going to get that, Henry?
I think they are going to get a substantial amount of it. I mean, actually, it's broader than just the vetting, Justin. They're also asking for things like the minutes of all meetings between Lord Mandelson and ministers, government officials and special advisers during his time as ambassador, all electronic communications between the Prime Minister's chief of staff, that's Morgan McSweeney, and Lord Mandelson relating to his links to Jeffrey Epstein, among other things. And they are seeking to do this via a device known as a humble address, which is a binding motion the House of Commons can pass in order to compel the release of documents from the government. Actually, among those who pioneered its use was Sir Keir Starmer, when he was shadow Brexit secretary. Now, what is telling is that the government is not seeking to vote down that Conservative motion. I think if they had sought to do that, they couldn't have been sure of winning, which is an extraordinary thing to say given the size of their majority. Instead, they are seeking to amend it. So they are saying they'll release all the things the Conservative have asked for, except papers prejudicial to UK national security or international relations. And they point to occasions where, when they were in opposition, they tabled motions like this, but included a national security caveat. I can't see examples, though, of them including an international relations caveat. And I do think that might be a line of attack for MPs this afternoon, is whether they are seeking to carve out too broad an exemption, even while the government is seeking to appear transparent.
And meanwhile, the pressure not just coming from the Conservatives, the pressure also coming from Gordon Brown.
Well, Gordon Brown is clearly furious, to say the very least, at what has transpired in these latest files. I mean, of course, it is Gordon Brown under whom Lord Mandelson was the deputy at the time that he is alleged to have passed sensitive government information to Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, it's Gordon Brown who brought Lord Mandelson back from his exile in Europe, where he was the Trade Commissioner, and gave him the peerage which this Labour government is now trying to strip him of. You know, there is sort of Shakespearean sort of levels of drama to this. I mean, there is still, I think, a clear political risk for the current government on this as well. This could have been, in a not too distant parallel universe, a major scandal about the man who was Deputy Prime Minister 17 years ago and has been influential on the right of the Labour Party for decades. But instead, it is a scandal about the man who was Britain's ambassador to the US last year on the appointment of this Prime Minister.
And we'll be talking to the Health Secretary for England, Wes Streeting, at 8:10. Henry Zeppman, thank you.
22 minutes to 7, and the man once known as Prince Andrew, now Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, is understood to have left the rather large large property he occupied in Windsor and is now at Sandringham in Norfolk. Daniela Rolfe is our senior royal correspondent. Daniela, nothing on the record from the palace, but what, they are discreetly letting it be known that he's gone from what you might call publicly owned Windsor to privately owned Sandringham?
Yeah, he has moved, Johnny. Yeah. We now know that with certainty. We last saw him in Windsor riding on horseback on Monday morning. We also saw him driving away, waving at people on the long walk in Windsor as he drove away from the castle later in the day on Monday too. But we know that the big move happened sometime on Monday evening. We knew that he would be moving from Royal Lodge back in October when the King announced in alongside him being stripped of all of his titles. And we were told, always told by Buckingham Palace, that he'd be moving in the early part of this year and when it was deemed practicable for him to do so. It seemed that moment, as the swirl of Epstein rumours continued to surround Andrew, it seemed that that moment of practicability was on Monday evening, and he was moved under darkness to Norfolk, which is now his home. We are told that he still has some belongings in Windsor, so we may still see him every now and then on the Windsor estate. But for now, his official residence will be at Sandringham on the King's private estate.
And I'm sure they're not giving a running commentary, but presumably the palace will be delighted to have him tucked out of the way in Norfolk on a private estate rather than more visible in Windsor.
Yeah, that's right. The key thing with a private estate, of course, is that it is owned by the King, and it means now that any funding of this move and of Andrew's life will be paid for by his older brother. There's no sense of any public money being used there. And I think the thing with Royal Lodge is it had come to symbolise so many of the problems with this story, with the story of Jeffrey Epstein and his relationship with Andrew, that had been such a problem for the royal family. It became the focus of conversations around privilege, around transparency, around the use of public money. So I think moving him away from Windsor and to the relative privacy of Sandringham will suit everybody.
Daniela, thank you very much. Daniela Rolfe, our senior royal correspondent.
19 minutes to 7 is the time. The thing the government wanted to talk about today is cancer, a new set of targets for treatment and survival. Hugh Pym, our health editor, is on the line. What are those targets, Hugh, and how do they differ from the ones they've got at the moment?
Well, they are very ambitious, Justin, and I think they'll be put under a lot of scrutiny. One of the key ones is survivability of cancer, just trying to get considerably more patients living longer over the next 10 years by 2035. So just to give you a little indication, survival rates across most cancers are around 60% after 5 years. They want to get that up to 75%. That's a UK-wide number. And to give it a couple of examples, five-year net survival for lung cancer in Norway is 20%, Canada about 22%, the UK 15%. For colon cancer, Norway 65%, Canada 67%, and the UK 59%. And certainly the health charities are saying it's vital to get those numbers up. Now, one way they want to do it is to hit an existing set of targets, which haven't been hit for a decade. And the crucial one is 62 days to start treatment after an urgent referral. That should be 85%. It's currently down at around 70%, and that by the end of this parliament. So very ambitious targets they've set out there.
But when you go through those figures for other countries, Hugh, what is it then that they're doing that we're not? Is it as raw and obvious as expenditure, or is it something else? I mean, this is a question for Wes Streeting at 8:10, but might as well ask you that now.
Well, I visited Denmark to look at this precise issue in the summer last year, and one thing that came across was they were very unhappy with their cancer performance a couple of decades ago, And it was a 10-year plan, and that's what Wes Streeting is setting out here. But it needed full political buy-in from all the different parties. It needed real determination. It needed more investment in equipment. And I think that's something that's going to be scrutinised. Where's the money going to come from for more equipment, for example, radiotherapy and other issues? And the government position is they are going to put more money into all this, but it's going to come from existing Department of Health budgets, which have already been set out over the next few years. But they do want to invest in robotic surgery, for example, which is a lot more efficient and better for patients, in more scanners and more diagnostics, in more community diagnostic centres. But I think the message is it is a long haul. It takes a lot of money. And, for example, the Nuffield Trust are saying it's very welcome, all this, but it's going to be incredibly difficult based on current performance for the NHS in England, certainly to hit that 62-day target.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
17 minutes to 7, and academic evidence suggests what many parents may have already worked out, that children who read for pleasure experience many and rich benefits, such as better vocabulary, empathy, mental well-being. It may even make them more affluent when they're adults. So MPs on the Education Select Committee have begun an inquiry into the benefits and the barriers to enjoying a good book. Our parliamentary correspondent Susan Hume reports on the opening day of their inquiry.
At the start of the session, it was obvious this wasn't going to be like The Gruffalo or that one about the girl who goes through the wardrobe into a snowy forest.
A more complex understanding of syntactic structures, expressive and receptive oral language.
Also symbolic thinking, so...
That is, of course, correlational, not causational evidence, but it's hugely corroborative.
Well, the expert witnesses were themselves clearly able to cope with very long and difficult words. And according to Professor Jesse Ricketts from Royal Holloway, University of London, being able to read confidently is key to enjoying it.
The proficiency is fantastically important. Like, it's the access point. So what we want is young people to get into this wonderful virtuous circle of feeling success in their reading, being good at reading, then reading more, and then practising that reading skill so that they get better at reading.
Well, the academics had a long list of the benefits of enjoying a good book. Even before they can read themselves, looking at a book could help small children bond with their parents. It could help them learn words they wouldn't hear day to day, and it could help them understand how people might think or act in situations they haven't themselves experienced, as Dr. Jo Taylor from University College London explained. She reads her toddler a picture book called Not Now, Bernard.
Bernard finds the monster eats him, and then the monster basically pretends to be Bernard. Bernard's being ignored by his parents, and the child is basically learning about this whole concept of potentially being ignored and how that might make you feel and what you might do in response. So you might pretend to be a monster and bite your daddy if you are being ignored.
Happily, it's not a situation her two-year-old finds himself in.
I'm sure he doesn't understand it all, but he's getting a much more complex set of emotional experiences through that book than he might be getting from, because we don't ignore him, so through his kind of everyday experiences.
Lots of people use e-books now, so a Lib Dem, Manuela Pertagella, wondered if that made a difference.
How does reading from a digital device differ from reading from a physical book?
The academics thought there was a lot to be said for printed paper. Dr. Jan Szynski, also from Royal Holloway, felt digital devices made it harder to get drawn into the story.
With the very youngest children, there are more distractions. So things like, even if the only difference between the two is that there is a button on the digital book that lets you turn the page, even that causes more distraction than turning the physical page in a physical book.
And there is some evidence that older children and teenagers find it easier to understand what they're reading from paper and ink rather than a screen, which should maybe give us pause for thought, according to Professor Jesse Ricketts.
Because what we know about what's happening in schools is that there is access to physical books, but there is also access to a lot of digital materials, and including digital books. I work with hundreds of secondary schools, and there are certainly secondary schools who have very little access to physical books and have a digital library instead. So this is a really pertinent question. This is something we need to really be thinking about.
And she pointed out that it was cheaper for schools to buy digital books. But where children were gripped by a story, it could be an important social tool, a kind of water cooler moment, as Professor Theresa Kremen from the Open University explained.
They're motivated for relational reasons. Their peers, perhaps, are reading a particular story and I want to read it too, like the Harry Potter phenomenon that came around. I want to connect to others, perhaps. I want to hear what others say. We're reading chapter 6 and I want to go, I read chapter 6, I want to know what they think. Did you think this? I didn't. I was surprised by that.
So to make sure children got to that point, Labour's Jessica Asato wondered,
are there any things that are regularly done in school settings that actually the research shows actually just doesn't really work?
Professor Teresa Kremen described how the joy could truly be sucked out of the whole experience.
School I work with called it required reading time, which is kind of tempting or not.
She continued,
perhaps the worst case scenario would be we have independent reading time and you will read. Yeah. We're not giving you book talk time. We're not supporting you to make choices. We're not reading aloud to you, but you will read in this time.
In the 2 hours of evidence, there'd certainly be no fidgeting or playing with his pen top from Labour's Mark Sewards.
Such a fascinating session today. I mean, the time's absolutely flown by. I've certainly got advice that I'm going to take back and use on my 4-year-old and 1-year-old.
So let's hope his family found a book and the book was good, to borrow from the Gruffalo.
Susan Hume there with Yesterday in Parliament. It is 12 minutes to 7. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, a son of the late Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi, was for years the Western friendly face of Gaddafi-run Libya. A fluent English speaker, educated at the London School of Economics, he led the international negotiations over Libya's weapons of mass destruction and over compensation for the families of those who lost their lives in the Lockerbie bombing. But Saif al-Islam Gaddafi is dead, shot and killed on Tuesday at his home in Libya. Robert Worth is a contributing writer at The Atlantic magazine. He met Saif Gaddafi in the summer of 2021, a decade after the revolution which toppled his father's 40-year-long rule.
Saif al-Islam was seen as the heir apparent of Gaddafi's regime. He was the Western-friendly face of the regime. He spoke good English. He was handsome. He'd gone to the London School of Economics. He was seen as a reformist, a more milder figure than his bloody father. When the revolt broke out in 2011, he then gave this fiery speech in which he sided fully with his father's crackdown against the protesters. He was then captured by rebels and more or less disappeared for years in the province of Zintan in western Libya.
I mean, he was pretty well known to Western interlocutors, wasn't he? I mean, he was part of the negotiations over Libya abandoning its weapons of mass destruction and over compensation for the families of those killed in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie. You met him. What was he like?
Well, I met him in 2021. And by that time, you know, he had been for 10 years living in the desert, initially as a captive. And then eventually his captors kind of let him go. And they realized eventually that Libyans had grown so sick of the chaos of their country that some of them had grown nostalgic for the Gaddafi era. And that gave him the potential to be a real political leader at some point.
He had an understanding of the West, a relationship with the West that survived those long years in captivity. And then as his thoughts turned again to the leadership of the country?
Yes. You know, I don't think he was in touch with people in the West during those years. But I think the fact that he had those ties was one of the things that made him seem like a potential political leader, unlike many of the other, you know, people in Libya. He definitely had this symbolic weight. He had, you know, name recognition. Yeah. And that counted for something.
He was still wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity for his role in the suppression of protests in 2011. Was there any reference when you met him to those charges, to the demands of some in the West that he turn himself in?
Yes, so that certainly came up, but he didn't take that seriously at all. Right. He said the witnesses against him had been paid and it was all nonsense. He didn't seem to view that as a real threat. And he expected to become, if not the leader of Libya, then a politically prominent figure. And he figured he would get some kind of immunity for those charges.
What will his death mean for Libya, if anything at all? I mean, is he part of Libya's present or is he really part of its past?
I think he's mostly part of its past. Right. He's someone who wasn't wielding any actual political power, but he had symbolic weight as someone who, again, because of his name recognition, might eventually have had some position in Libya. It's really hard to say because there haven't been elections for many years now. Yeah. It's not really even possible to say when there might be elections again, but there are certainly people who viewed him as a potential future threat, and presumably those are the ones who killed him.
Robert Worth, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
And that brings us to 8 minutes to seven. The latest drop of documents and pictures from the Epstein investigations have led to huge consequences, of course, in this country, plainly. But what they have significantly failed to do is lead to anyone being prosecuted for abusing the women who say they were trafficked and abused by Epstein and some of his friends. I've been talking to the Democrat Congressman Suhas Subramaniam, who is a member of the House of Representatives Oversight Committee. Now, that committee has been very much leading the way in trying to get to the bottom of what actually happened and who was responsible. So I asked him, are we any closer to prosecutions of the men who took part in abuse?
Well, I think we're closer than when we started this investigation. But, you know, part of the issue is that we're not getting all of the evidence we need. Some of it's being withheld. I would say that even if there's no prosecutions in the court of law, I think the victims and their families do feel some sort of sense of justice from even seeing people lose their jobs or their board positions or their titles. And so even in the United States, where there's, you know, statutes of limitations. So you can't prosecute someone for a crime that happened a certain while ago. You can still get that sense of justice in other ways.
But do you think that's what we're talking about now, a sense of justice rather than justice itself?
I think it's better than nothing, which is what's happened to date. I think a lot of people did horrible things and faced no consequences at all and had their reputations intact. And, so when you see the victims who felt powerless all these years and you feel sort of their energy when they see someone finally seeing consequences for their actions, I think that's definitely progress.
But what they're not seeing is people who actually physically abused them, sexually abused them, going to court and facing accusations in court. And that seems to be the thing that is missing here.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And again, I see it as my job in Congress. I'm not law enforcement, but this investigation's about the terrible things that were done, the crimes that were committed, as well as the cover-up by law enforcement, by very powerful and rich people. And so I want to make sure people at least trust us, elected officials and government institutions, and certainly see how we can prevent this from happening in the future, because people who committed these crimes should have faced justice.
What difference, if any, do you think the testimony of Bill and Hillary Clinton would make?
I don't think it would make much of a difference. I think part of the reason they have been named is because, one, you know, Bill Clinton was shown in pictures in some of the files, but two, they were political enemies of Republicans and of Donald Trump, who said he wanted to make this investigation about Democrats. But, we're going to have them come testify. They agreed to all of the terms the committee put forward, and we'll see what they have to say.
They also said that they wanted to set a precedent. In other words, they thought other people ought to do the same thing. If Lord Mandelson, Peter Mandelson, is he someone you'd like to talk to as on the committee?
Yeah, absolutely. Lord Mandelson should come before a committee. So should Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and anyone else who is engaged or involved or has knowledge of Jeffrey Epstein and his crimes, because we want all the information necessary. We also want to understand what was happening and how he was, if he was manipulating people or how he was interacting with people with power and prestige.
What do you make of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's refusal so far to cooperate with the committee?
I'm not surprised. One, we don't have the ability to hold them in contempt. One of the ways the Clintons, agreed to all the terms we've set forth was that we held them in civil contempt and potentially we're going to hold them in criminal contempt. We don't have that ability with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And so the only pressure on him is public pressure. But certainly as someone, you know, with his reputation on the line and with, you know, given where he comes from and his family, you would think he would want to clear his name. And this is the opportunity to do that. And so it's disappointing that he hasn't come forward with more information, but we would like to hear from him.
Congressman Suhas Subramanian, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Skis cutting through snow at breathtaking speed. Snowboards spinning in ways never seen before. Skeleton sleds pushing the limits. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics starts Friday, live across the BBC.
Follow that, Darren Bett.
Yeah, thank you very much, Justin. We've got some snow in the UK, actually, today, as we've seen over the past couple of weeks or so. Colder air across some northern areas, but it is turning milder from the south. But we've got the wet weather to begin with across northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Rain, but also some sleet and snow over the hills of northern England. And for a while, to low levels in Scotland. So some tricky travelling conditions here. I think the snow will tend to lift onto the higher hills and mountains, but it will stay a bit damp throughout the day, I think, in Scotland, and temperatures will reach 4 or 5 degrees. In Northern Ireland and Northern England, the wet weather that we start with will move northwards, so it will turn dry through the afternoon, but it's likely to stay cloudy, and temperatures will reach 7 Celsius. It's further south that we'll see the milder air across more southern parts of England and into Wales, parts of the Midlands as well. But there's some mist and fog around this morning, dense in places. It will slowly lift. The cloud should break a little to allow some places to see a bit of welcome sunshine, and temperatures will reach 11 Celsius. Overnight tonight, the southeasterly wind will be a bit stronger, so any mist and fog is likely over the hills. It should be frost-free. There will be some wet weather still in Scotland, northeast England, some snow over the Grampians, and we've got some wetter, windier weather coming into more southern parts of England and Wales. That'll move northwards tomorrow. A mixture of rain, sleet and some snow over the hills for northern areas. There'll be a stronger wind and it will feel colder again.
Thanks very much, Darren. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Johnny Diamond.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of February. The headlines this morning. The government's appointment of Lord Mandelson as UK ambassador to the US will come under scrutiny in the Commons. Number 10 says it is willing to release some documents related to the process. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has moved out of his home in Windsor. And ministers say their new 10-year plan for treating cancer in England will give every patient the best possible chance of beating the disease.
Coming up in the next hour, General Keith Kellogg, until very recently President Trump's man in Kiev, gives us his take on how to force Putin to accept peace.
I think Putin is working from a disadvantage. He's afraid, even though he talks big. He doesn't have the combat power. You know, it comes down to raw power. And I think they have to play from that perspective.
And remember Britain's curling heroes from 4 years ago?
You've got Eve Muirhead in her fourth Olympic Games, finally carrying off a very shiny gold medal with a team around her who've never been to Olympic Games. Very satisfied with that.
Will they be sweeping up again, get it, as the Winter Olympics gets underway? The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The government says it will release some documents relating to its decision to appoint Lord Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to Washington after further revelations about his links to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Their publication isn't expected to happen immediately. The Conservatives have been pushing for more details about the vetting process, which saw the former Labour minister appointed to the role this time last year. He was sacked in September. The Metropolitan Police is to investigate allegations that when Lord Mandelson was business secretary in 2009, he shared market-sensitive information with Epstein. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
These documents concern Sir Keir Starmer's decision to resurrect Peter Mandelson's career and send him to Washington. The Conservatives have tabled a rare parliamentary motion known as a humble address to try to force the release of information. They want all papers relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment published, details of his vetting for the role, and communications between him and officials, including the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. Such is the anger at Peter Mandelson, it was clear that many Labour MPs would not have been willing to oppose the Tory motion had the government tried to vote it down. Instead, the Prime Minister has amended it, agreeing to publish the documents apart from those deemed prejudicial to national security or international relations. As for Lord Mandelson, he will now face questioning from Scotland Yard as part of an investigation into allegations of misconduct in public office. He has not commented publicly on the latest developments, but is understood to believe he did not act criminally, nor did he act to gain personally, and he will cooperate with the police.
The Labour MP Clive Effort told The World Tonight here on Radio 4 that full disclosure was needed. He added that there was a sense within the party that they'd been let down by Lord Mandelson.
It's actually quite shocking and really leaves a bitter taste in the mouth. Every Labour MP will be absolutely distraught by what he's done to our party and feel really let down. And they all understand that, you know, warts and all, this has got to be put out in the open.
Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has moved from his home in Windsor to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk. Buckingham Palace announced last October that he would no longer be allowed to live at Royal Lodge following revelations then linked to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. There have been more in recent days. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was last seen in public on Monday. He was pictured on a horse ride close to his former home in Windsor and was then seen driving from the castle, waving at passers-by. We now know that on Monday evening, as further revelations emerged around his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, he left Windsor for good and made the move to his new base on the Sandringham estate. His permanent home will be Marsh Farm, but that property is currently undergoing renovations, so he'll stay temporarily at Wood Farm, a property previously used by his father, Prince Philip. Sandringham is owned privately by the King, and he will pay the costs of his brother's new home. Thames Valley Police also say they are assessing information following claims Jeffrey Epstein sent a woman to Royal Lodge in 2010 for a sexual encounter with Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. The woman's lawyer has told the BBC she spent the night with the former prince and was then given a tour of Buckingham Palace. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has not responded to the allegations. He has always denied any wrongdoing.
Ministers are promising that far more patients diagnosed with cancer will survive for 5 years or longer by 2035. The pledge is included in a new 10-year cancer plan for the NHS in England. Charities have welcomed the government's ambitions, but some experts have expressed doubt about whether the targets are realistic. More from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A key cancer target in England is that 85% of patients should begin their treatment within 62 days of an urgent referral, but this hasn't been met since 2014. Currently, 70% hit that goal. Ministers say this will now be achieved by March 2029, along with two other targets, one covering rapid diagnosis. The government says around 60% of patients currently survive 5 years or more, a lower rate than in Poland and Romania for some cancers. The aim is to get this to 75% by 2035. The plan proposes investing more in scanners and digital technology to speed up diagnosis and more robot-assisted surgery. Cancer Research UK said this was a significant commitment. The Nuffield Trust think tank said the ambition was welcome, but the NHS would find the targets incredibly difficult to meet based on current performance.
Ukraine and Russia are to resume peace talks in Abu Dhabi under the auspices of the US. Yesterday, President Zelensky said Russian airstrikes on the Ukrainian energy network showed Moscow was choosing terror over diplomacy. The last remaining nuclear weapons treaty between the United States and Russia expires later today. As our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports, there's uncertainty about any future mutually agreed restrictions.
For more than half a century, the United States and Russia agreed to limit the size of their nuclear arsenals. They signed a succession of treaties to cap and inspect each other's stockpiles. But now the last such agreement between both countries is due to lapse, ending all legal restraint on the military ambition of the world's two biggest nuclear powers. The New START Treaty was signed in 2010, imposing a limit of about 1,500 strategic nuclear warheads deployed on no more than 700 missiles or bombers. Some hope its expiry could trigger fresh arms control negotiations, but others fear a new arms race in an increasingly unstable world.
A review has recommended creating a new post at the heart of government to oversee criminal courts in England and Wales. The retired judge, Sir Brian Leveson, was asked by ministers to look at ways of reducing the unprecedented backlog of cases. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Sir Brian says his recommendations mustn't lead to a pick-and-mix job, and ministers, the police, judges and others must all act quickly. He wants a dedicated advisor answerable to the Prime Minister to oversee efficiency reforms across the fragmented justice system and more use of artificial intelligence tools to help prepare cases more quickly and judges to better schedule trials. The Law Society, which represents criminal solicitors, says the report underlines the need for more funding across the courts. Ministers are expected to respond to the proposals within weeks.
The public spending watchdog is warning that prison security systems are being left unrepaired, allowing drugs to be delivered to inmates. The National Audit Office says the government has underspent on measures aimed at combating the problem. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Katecha.
Last April, nearly half the prison population in England and Wales, about 40,000 inmates, were identified as having a drug problem. Drugs finds in cells were recorded 23,000 times last year, up 25% on the previous 12 months. But despite these challenges, the report says that in recent years, the prison service used only three quarters of its £100 million security investment budget. Money ministers allocated for work such as fixing broken windows and X-ray machines wasn't spent. In some cases, those repairs have taken years, making it easier for drugs to get in. The cost of the maintenance backlog doubled to almost £2 million between 2020 and 2024. The government says it's committed about £40 million for security measures to stop drones coming into high-risk prisons.
The first competitive action of the Winter Olympics in Italy starts this evening, 2 days before the opening ceremony. The British pair of Bruce Mowat and Jen Dodds will take part in the mixed doubles curling. Overall, Team GB has been set a target of winning between 4 and 8 medals. Last time around in Beijing, they managed 2.
Thanks very much, Alan. It looks very much as if the government is going to release the documents that will tell some of the story, at any rate, as to why Sir Keir Starmer sent Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, to Washington last year. The Conservatives planned something of a parliamentary ambush today by petitioning for the release of the papers in what's called a humble address. But the government has decided, we understand, to publish those documents rather than face a difficult vote, apart from documents deemed prejudicial to either national security or international relations. Kevin Hollenrake is chairman of the Conservative Party. He joins us. Good morning.
Morning.
What do you think you will learn from these documents?
We'll probably learn a lot about Keir Starmer's judgment, we think. I mean, we're yet to see exactly what these documents will reveal, but the reality is Keir Starmer knew that he was appointing one of the dodgiest people in politics to the role of ambassador to the United States, one of the best jobs in politics. He knew of his background. He knew his relationship with Epstein, and he still pushed ahead and appointed him. I mean, it speaks volumes about Keir Starmer's judgment. And I think the fact he's caving in today in terms of our humble address, our procedure to force him to release the information he's given into that, just shows a lot about his weakness and the fact he's constantly pushed around by his backbenchers because he has simply no backbone.
I'm sure many people would like to see those documents, would like to see the sort of chain of reasoning that went on. Others may criticise you because of where your focus is on what they might say is sort of rather petty party politics compared to what is an astonishing network of men often exploiting women or trading favours with one very rich man. Is there the threat of politicising something that's a bit more important than party politics?
Well, those revelations are disgraceful, of course, in terms of the sex trafficking side of this. But let's not forget, back in 2008, when Mandelson was corresponding with a known paedophile, 2008-2009, This is a time when millions of people were being put out of work in this country, 3.7 million people. I was in business myself at the time, and my business is under threat, like millions of other businesses were. And Mandelson, what he was doing at that time is seeking to do favours to his best pal and to enrich himself in the process. I think that's incredibly serious, these accusations. I think his former colleague, Gordon Brown, has called it unpatriotic. So I think this is incredibly serious. It's right that the police are investigating. They must be allowed to do their work. But I think everybody, given the nature of the revelations, would think it must be the case that a prosecution will ensue from this. So I think this is not petty party politics. This is hugely serious.
And the government, we understand, will exempt those papers which could damage national security or international relations. Are you happy with that exemption?
Well, again, we don't know. We don't know what we don't know. That's the problem. But I think it would be wrong that anything would be held back just because it might embarrass Keir Starmer or the Labour government. They must reveal this information. Hugely serious series of accusations. To be fair, it undermines the whole of politics in people's eyes, which cannot be right. What the Prime Minister must do is make sure all this information is revealed, and it may be embarrassing to Keir Starmer personally, it may be embarrassing to the government, but that's a side issue right now. What's really important is we restore people's faith in the world of politics. Most people don't try and enrich themselves when they go into politics. They do these things for the right reasons. And the reality is Peter Mandelson's a wrong'un, and Keir Starmer knew that when he appointed him.
But protection of national security presumably is a valid reason, as far as you're concerned, for holding back at least some material.
Yes, of course it would be, but we don't want to use that as some kind of smokescreen not to reveal other things that would be embarrassing to the government or embarrassing to Keir Starmer. It's embarrassing enough already. This is a person who, until Kemi Badenoch challenged Keir Starmer in the House in September, Starmer was saying he had full confidence in Peter Mandelson. I mean, despite the fact he knew about the Epstein relationship, he must have known, he knew about the previous resignations, he knew it was a high-risk appointment, and these further revelations were coming to light. Yet Keir Starmer was stood there in the Commons saying he had full confidence in Peter Mandelson. It is shocking. So I think Keir Starmer has no option now, and his backbenchers are calling for this as well now, on the basis of what we have done, the parliamentary procedure we're taking forward today. He has no option now but to make a clean breast of everything, and the national security argument should not be a reason not to reveal things that are personally damaging to Keir Starmer.
Kevin Hollerich, Chairman of the Conservative Party, thank you for joining us.
Quarter past seven is the time. It emerged late last night that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor had moved out of his home in Windsor to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk, Buckingham Palace announcing last October, of course, that he was going to leave the Royal Lodge following revelations then about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. He has always denied any wrongdoing. Let us talk to Roy Anika, the Royal Editor for The Times, who's on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you think the events of the last few days, and particularly the enormous cache of material that we've just had released, have affected the timing of this move?
Yes, definitely. There's absolutely no doubt that I think Andrew Mountbatten Windsor thought he'd have a little bit more time to gather his things and move up to Norfolk. But I think what we've seen over the last few days from Friday night onwards, not only in terms of what we've seen emerge from the Epstein files, but the way we have seen Andrew respond to that with no comment at all, but happily wafting round Windsor Great Park on a horse past camera crews, I think that has not gone down well with the King at all, who is increasingly exasperated by his brother's behaviour. And I think that move to Norfolk has certainly been expedited by what we've seen in the last few days.
And the point being that Norfolk is private and he's not going to be seen.
Well, I think that's probably the intention, but Andrew has a way of making himself seen when the rest of his family hope he'll stay out of sight. So it remains to be seen. I mean, we're told that he will be back down to Royal Lodge. It implies this really has been hastily done and he hasn't quite finished packing up. But I think the intention would be to keep him, you know, he's going to be staying temporarily at Wood Farm, family home on the Sandringham estate, before he moves to Marsh Farm, his more permanent home. And I think the hope from the King and the rest of the family was that he really will keep his head down for a bit.
Are they also hoping that he does testify to the House of Representatives Committee? Because we heard from a congressman on that committee just half an hour or so ago saying, yep, they still want him to, and he hasn't, of course, at the moment. I don't think he's responded at all to their request. Are you getting any sense at all that there is pressure from him from within the family?
I think at the point that you have palace sources, which we have seen in the last few days, briefing that it is for Andrew's conscience whether or not he testifies, is a key indicator of where the rest of the family are at. I mean, we had Prince Edward yesterday, you know, talking about remembering the victims. We had the King and Queen in a statement talking about remembering the victims. But, you know, it's down to Andrew to do the right thing. And as we have seen in the last few months and actually years, the judgment there is questionable. He's not known for doing the right thing.
Roy Nicker, Royal Editor of the Sunday Times, not the Times. Thank you very much for talking to us.
17 minutes past seven.
Now, let us turn to something that the government wants to talk about today, the National Cancer Plan. It's being launched today. It sets out targets for 75% of cancer patients to be cancer-free or living well after 5 years. The current figure is 60%. It is ambitious, a revolution, according to the Health Secretary for England, Wes Streeting, from whom we are going to hear at 10 past eight. Cancer is more likely to be a death sentence in Britain, he says, than other countries around the world. As a cancer survivor, I owe my life to the NHS. I owe it to future patients to make sure they receive the same outstanding care I did. And he makes it plain that at the moment they do not. Let us talk to Michelle Mitchell, who is Chief Executive of Cancer Research and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Just what do you make first of the targets that are being suggested? If they could be achieved, how much of a difference would it make?
Well, it would absolutely make a huge difference. At the heart of this plan is a commitment to increase early diagnosis 75% by 2035. And that matters hugely to cancer patients because we know with the majority of cancers, the earlier people are treated, the more likely they are to survive. If you're diagnosed at stage one with bowel cancer, your survival is about 90%. At stage four, it's 10%. So early diagnosis matters. And what we've seen today is an acknowledgement by the Secretary of State of the serious situation that cancer survival and outcomes are in the UK. Let's remember, we lag 10 to 15 years behind comparable countries, Sweden, Canada, Australia, and the cancer waiting times for treatment haven't been met since 2015. In fact, in November, if they had been met, 4,000 more people would have been treated. So we will be able to judge in 1 year's time, in 5 years' time, whether the bold ambitions, many of which are incredibly welcome, the commitment to meet cancer waiting times by the end of the parliament, the early diagnosis targets that you mentioned, Justin, the improvements and expansion of screening, strengthened leadership in cancer research and accelerating clinical trials, all strong foundations for progress. However, plans don't save lives.
Well,
delivery
yes.
does.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's got to be the focus next.
And I'll just get on to the delivery in a second. But first, just on the what is achievable, I suppose. Because we tend sometimes to sort of throw our hands up in the air and say everything's broken, we can't do things in this country. The example of Denmark, which was being given earlier by Hugh Pimmer, health editor, is interesting, isn't it? Because they were in a seriously awful situation and they got out of it.
Absolutely. So we should start with the premise that we can make this a turning point on cancer for cancer patients in England. We have, if we follow a strong, clear strategy, we focus on those interventions that make the biggest impact and difference. A number of them are in the plan today. And we fund and finance the people and the kit that's needed to transform cancer outcomes in England. It can be done, but it will take a decade.
And when it comes to the funding, what are we talking about? What are we talking about, tweaking here or there existing budgets or something much more fundamental?
Well, what we've heard today is a re-announcement of existing funding commitments, some new funding commitments to cancer. They're very welcome, but we must remember that we're going to have by 2040, 500,000 people diagnosed with cancer. So we're going to see a rising demand. Right. And we have to also be cognizant that there's real-term pressures in the NHS. We need longer-term planning on workforce and investment in capital.
Right, when you say longer-term planning on workforce, we just don't have the people at the moment to do the work that is being envisaged, is that right?
So the demand is outstripping supply, certainly in cancer and oncology. There are major shortfalls in, for example, radiologists, which is just under 30% at the moment and likely to get worse in broader oncology specialisms. We're looking at 15% shortfall. So in addition to this bold plan, which is important, which has several welcome measures, we also want to see long-term planning for the workforce in cancer, and we want to see increased multi-year commitments so that the kit is there and that we can really as a country take advantage of the data and digital transformations which will transform care for cancer patients in time. So a good start, but delivery, not plans, will save lives.
All right, well, we'll talk about delivery to Wes Streeting. We've got a lot to talk to him about when we talk to him at 10 past 8. Michelle Mitchell, Chief Executive of Cancer Research. Thank you.
22 minutes past 7, and renewable energy company SSE says it has had three quarters of the approvals needed for the £33 billion investment plan it announced a few months ago. Sean Farrington has more.
Yeah, you can imagine, Johnny, there's lots of consents and approvals that might be needed along the way, never mind actually carrying out so many of these projects that SSE were giving us a flavour of back in November when it announced that £33 billion into the UK's electricity network, mostly in the north of Scotland. Since then, for example, we've heard it's won a 20-year contract to produce low-carbon offshore wind power in Scotland. Sam Peacock is the Managing Director of Corporate Affairs, Regulation and Strategy at SSE. Morning, Sam.
Morning, John.
Now that you've had a sort of few months to get into this plan that you announced, what has become the biggest obstacle to actually carrying it out in a timely manner and in budget?
I mean, overall, it feels like we're getting some real momentum behind our plan. Sean, we've got the £33 billion investment plan. We're starting to get those consents coming through. I thought planning might be an obstacle, but actually we're starting to get some consents coming through from planning. We've won that offshore wind contract recently, as you mentioned, for Berwick Bank. So it feels, even though there's that kind of world of volatile geopolitics, it does feel the homegrown electricity is coming through. So we are.
Has that surprised you, the planning approvals?
No, I mean, when you speak to communities around things like pylons, you tend to get 70% around positive or neutral, and then maybe 8 to 20% against. So I'd expect most of the consents to come through, and we need that infrastructure to help, you know, rewire Britain, really.
But I just wonder, given how much we've talked about changes to the planning process that are supposed to be being put in place, whether you are actually seeing any of that, where some approvals are going through that perhaps in the past wouldn't.
It's hard to know, kind of counterfactual, but we are certainly seeing momentum in our plan. If you think about our projects, so sort of 34, so far we've got 25 of the transmission planning projects coming through. What I suppose really important is that these investments will start to unlock cleaner electricity across the country. You need that transmission lines to move the cheaper renewables around the country to people's homes and businesses.
But still at a potentially quite high price for customers. When we see at the price that has been, you know, locked in for many of these bills, it could well be that that's still above what might be the current wholesale cost for customers that they could potentially be paying at the moment, because they've had to lock in at a higher price for a longer period of time.
I mean, the reality is that renewables are the cheapest option for the country as a whole. I mean, we built the UK's largest gas power station, the most recent one, and the cost of building that today is over 3.5 times what we paid for the kit. So when you look at a renewables-led transition, you get the energy security built in, you get the homegrown independence, it's cheaper, and then you get all the emissions and other benefits like jobs too. So for me, the renewables-led transition is the only really viable route for the country.
Okay, Sam Peacock there from SSE.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's 25 past 7. A ban on pupils in England using smartphones during the school day was backed last night in the House of Lords, 178 votes to 140. A defeat there for the government. It comes after Spain yesterday became the latest European country to make plans to ban social media for under-16s, following the example of Australia at the end of last year. The UK government is consulting on the move here too, and over the past few weeks we've discussed many of the concerns and possible solutions around screen time and phones here on Today. The passion on both sides of the argument was very evident last night when Amol presented the Today debate with the question, is social media bad for humanity? Amongst the panel was Esther Jai, whose daughter Brianna was murdered in 2023 and who's campaigning now for smartphone-free childhoods.
I would go as far to liken social media to a gateway drug. So Brianna, when she was alive, she was self-harming, she had an eating disorder. She really struggled with her mental health, and it was only after she passed away that I found out she'd been accessing really harmful content and forums online that was encouraging her to do so. I don't know where that would have ended. I really struggled to help her through this. I didn't understand what she was going through because I wasn't brought up in the online world. But yeah, children still have access to the dark web, and I think that this is something that really needs to be regulated, and maybe this is a focus that Ofcom should be driving towards rather than focusing too much on social media companies.
On the question of the addictive nature of social media, Amol challenged Anthony Walker, Deputy CEO of industry group Tech UK.
Anthony, a lot of people make the comparison between tech and, in a previous era, big tobacco. And they say, you know, in the end, people said, turns out the evidence is accumulated, tobacco does cause cancer, we should make an intervention. And if adults still want to do it, you can do it, but it's regulated and it's taxed. What's the difference here?
I don't think anybody's saying that we shouldn't be trying to create an online environment for children that is different to the online environment we have for adults. So I think there is a broad recognition that that's the journey that we're on. And we've seen, we've a significant piece of legislation passed in the UK. It took a long time to get passed, but it's now in force. We've got a world-leading regulator who's tasked with implementing that regulation. And I think the question is kind of how we build on that, how we continue to create that earlier experience of the online world in a way that enables children to get all the positive benefits from it, but also develop the skills that they're going to need as they enter into this digital world.
Well, Silky Carlo, director of the civil liberties group Big Brother Watch, had this exchange with Justine Roberts, founder of Mumsnet, about whether a government ban for teenagers was the way to go.
Only a minority of parents actually use software controls to monitor and manage how their children use social media and screen time. You can start with the device. How is the device used? Where is it used and when? And then what activity is done on the device? And there's all kind of software you can use on the platforms, also on the devices. You can't simply ask the government to solve those domestic issues for you. It won't work.
Why not? We ask the government to solve all kinds of issues around kids. When we think kids are harmed or it's unhealthy for them to have stuff, cigarettes, tobacco, why social media is up there. Why don't we just accept that we ask the government to do it?
I mean, likewise.
It's not a family. You cannot expect us to out-parent business models.
And the 30-year-old YouTuber Max Fosch, who has more than 6 million followers on his social media channels, extolled the benefits for content creators of his generation.
I just find it to be a very, very positive thing for anyone who's looking to go into business to like back themselves to go on their own. Now, that is a different conversation to when it comes to kind of protecting children online, which I do think is very, very important. But I just love the opportunity that YouTube brings and content creation brings, because ultimately you talk about these algorithms. I see algorithms as people. If people like your stuff, then it'll be showed to more people and then more people will see your stuff. And so often I think the conversation about algorithms is very abstract and spooky and scary because we can't quite understand it and wrap our heads around it. From my perspective, I just see algorithms as people.
Well, you can listen to the whole debate here on Radio 4 after the news at 11 o'clock or, of course, on BBC Sounds. Just search for the Today debate.
Half past seven is the time. Mike's here with sport.
Justin, thank you. The quadruple still on for Arsenal.
Wembley! 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 We're here to find this Arsenal and we're going to Wembley! Wembley! Wembley!
Shot on to Rice. Rice inside. This is Havertz. Havertz looks to go round the goalkeeper and scores! Arsenal are going to Wembley! The semi-final hoodoo is banished! That's the goal to seal it!
I tell you what, I was having the right moment at that referee. Blow that whistle, but thank God you didn't, mate. Because you give us the best moment for a long, long time at the Emirates. Yeah. Kai Havertz and all scoring the goal. Yeah. And I don't care what anybody says. I knew he was going to celebrate, and I love him. Well done, Kai!
Yes, the usual cast of characters on Arsenal Fan TV never let you down, do they? But there were wild celebrations for that late, late winner from Kai Havertz last night, deep into injury time. It secured a 1-0 win for Arsenal on the night in their League Cup semi-final second leg. Overall, they beat Chelsea by 4-2 on aggregate. Arsenal then still in the hunt for all four trophies this season. Here is their Dutch defender, Julian Timber.
The potential is there, definitely, and the desire is there as well. I think we are very hungry. I think you can see that we're in an amazing position. At the same time, we have nothing still. So, what I said, it's amazing going to Wembley, still final to play and a lot to play for the season. We just have to go and grab it.
Well, Arsenal will face either Manchester City or Newcastle in the League Cup final next month at Wembley. Those two meet tonight in the other semi-final second leg, City leading 2-0 in that tie. You can hear it on 5 Live from 8 p.m. Next, to a dramatic night at the top of the Scottish Premiership.
How much longer will the referee play? There goes the final whistle! A dramatic turn potentially in the race for the title as 10-man Hearts lose in Paisley. A fascinating twist in the race for the title.
Could well be, because Hearts missed the chance to go 9 points clear at the top of the table last night after a 1-0 loss to St Mirren for the third time in 4 matches. Derek McInnes' side also had a man sent off.
We've caused our problems ourselves, no more than that, to be honest. You know, we've got a good game to respond to. Obviously, any time we've only lost 3, that's our third defeat now in the league, and my response has always been good. No greater game to have that response. Hibs next Tuesday at Tynecastle, so we'll lick our wounds. It's been quite challenging, and it's even more challenging when you get out to 10 men for the players, but we're better than what we showed tonight, and ultimately it's cost us.
Yes, next up for Hearts in the league is the Edinburgh Derby next Tuesday. In cricket, England won the third T20 against Sri Lanka yesterday to complete a 3-0 series whitewash ahead of the start of the T20 World Cup, which begins in India and Sri Lanka this weekend. Meanwhile, it is Super Bowl week in the United States. The most watched annual sporting event in the world takes place on Sunday. And in a safety briefing yesterday, we were told that there will be no ICE agents on duty at the showpiece event this weekend. The US Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, had said in October last year that ICE agents will be, quote, all over the event. But here is Kathy Lehner, the NFL's chief security officer.
The federal presence here is consistent with past Super Bowls and other sporting events like what you will see around the World Cup and the Olympics as well. There are no planned ICE or immigration enforcement operations that are scheduled around the Super Bowl or any of the Super Bowl related events. There are no known, specific, or credible threats to the Super Bowl or any of our related events.
And the Super Bowl gets underway this Sunday. And coming up in the next hour of the programme, just to say, as we heard earlier in the news, the first action of the Winter Olympics starts today, which means we'll be hearing a lot of this over the next few weeks.
Clean up, yeah.
Pressure. The Olympic semi-final can play tricks. How's this going to finish?
Good, that boy.
Oh, what a shot there. What precision.
Curling on the radio, does it work? We can start a campaign for it here. But the curling does indeed get underway today at Milan Cortina, the mixed doubles, and we'll be speaking to Britain's best medal hope, Jen Dodds and Bruce Mowat, in the next hour of the programme. And I think we're also talking curling before 8 o'clock as well. You wait 4 years for a curling item on the Today programme and you get 2 in an hour.
Can't wait.
Everything works on the radio, Mike. You know that. It is 8:25. On Sunday, we continue our series of dramas tracing the stories that shaped a nation.
Radio 4's Story of America.
I know you, Scarlett.
You can buy me as many fine hats as you like, but I will never need you, Rhett Butler.
In the shadows of the Civil War.
There's no food, there's no money, there's nothing left here but trouble.
An epic tale of love and loss.
Rhett, I'm so sorry.
My darling, I know you didn't love me when we married. Fool that I was, I thought I could change that.
Rhett! Rhett!
Margaret Mitchell's award-winning novel, Gone with the Wind, begins on Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Tomorrow is another day.
Weather-wise, we're going to see some sunshine, at least in the south. It's going to be much brighter than it has been. Spells of rain and hail snow, though, in the north.
Coming up in the next half hour, get your brooms ready. Will Britain sweep up again in this year's Winter Olympics curling? I can't do that pun anymore. That's twice in 1 hour.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Johnny Diamond, Justin Webb. The time, 24 minutes to 8. Alan Smith has the news.
The chairman of the Conservative Party, Kevin Holyrake, has told this programme that Sir Keir Starmer should ensure that all information is revealed relating to his appointment of Lord Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to the US. Allegations that Peter Mandelson shared sensitive data with Jeffrey Epstein while serving as a cabinet minister in 2009 have prompted calls for the government to reveal its vetting processes. The Metropolitan Police is investigating the allegations. It's understood that Lord Mandelson believes he had not acted criminally. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has moved out of Windsor to the Sandringham estate. Thames Valley Police is assessing allegations that a second woman was sent to the UK by Epstein for a sexual encounter with the former prince at the Windsor estate in 2010. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has previously strongly denied wrongdoing. The government has given the NHS in England ambitious new targets to bring down waiting times for cancer treatment. The 10-year plan aims for 75% of people diagnosed with the disease to be cancer-free for 5 years or more by 2035. Cancer charities have called the strategy bold, but say more investment will be needed. The last nuclear arms control agreement between Russia and the United States expires later today, ending all legal restraints on their arsenals. And analysts fear it might lead to a new arms race, with more countries seeking to become nuclear powers. And the retired senior judge Sir Brian Leveson has urged the Prime Minister to appoint a new justice advisor answerable to Number 10 to oversee the criminal courts. In his second report on the backlog in cases in England and Wales, Sir Brian warns that the system is on the brink of collapse and urgent action is needed.
Thank you. 23 minutes to 8. What on earth is the point of the peace talks getting underway again today between Ukraine and Russia? The Russians are doing their best to destroy life for Ukrainians. It doesn't look from their actions as if they are interested in any kind of peace. General Keith Kellogg was President Trump's envoy to Ukraine until he came to the end of his term last month. He was seen as too pro-Ukraine by Russia and had little to do with the details of the negotiations to end the war. I've been talking to him, and we began with what his view is now of the talks and the wider picture as well.
Putin says one thing and does something different. What he's trying to do is basically break the will of the Ukrainian people. It's winter. It is very cold. He's putting massive missile and drone attacks, and he hopes to break them. It's sort of like what you went through, England, during the Blitz of World War II. It's an attack on the population centers. It's an attack on their morale. And I don't think it's going to work. But if they can get through the winter, if they can get through the next, say, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks at the most, then I think the advantage starts to accrue to the Ukrainians. Russia is not strong. Russia is not winning this fight.
When people hear you saying those words, many of them will say, why can't Donald Trump say the same? Why do you think he isn't?
Well, I will not speak for the president, and I don't know what the president's going to say or what he wants to say. I'm just telling you from my perspective, we've advanced more in the last year than President Biden did in 4 years. I mean, look, just one example, only one. The fact that he at least started negotiations with Putin. For 4 years, President Biden did not talk to Putin at all. You have got to talk to your adversary. You've got to talk to your enemy. That's rule number one, whether you like it or not. And right now, I think what Putin is trying to do, he's trying to break the will of Ukrainians. My experience from being in Kyiv, from being in Kharkiv, that's not going to work.
Is it your advice to the Ukrainians, then, that they should carry on with these talks in the Gulf? President Zelensky himself says he's going to adjust what they're doing out there, but there'll be a lot of Ukrainians, a lot of supporters of Ukraine, who say, why on earth are they having to go through what will seem to many like a sort of farcical set of talks when they're under such attack?
Well, I don't think any talks are farcical. I think the fact is that you're talking and you're keeping the dialogue open is important. The one who's holding up the peace process is not Zelensky. It's not the Ukrainians. The one who's holding up the peace process is Putin and the Russians.
If there is a ceasefire, are you convinced that the Europeans between them would be able to enforce it properly? Because there is, of course, a lot of discussion at the moment, isn't there, about how it would be enforced. And a lot of military people, particularly in Britain, actually saying, this is going to be more difficult, possibly, than some of the governments are admitting to their own populations.
I think that Europe, writ large, is a lot stronger than they think they are. Let's use England, nuclear power. Use France, a nuclear power. They've got forces on the ground. They're building up their force structure today. And as time goes along, together, NATO is a lot stronger than Russia. I think Putin is working from a disadvantage. He's afraid, even though he talks big. He doesn't have the combat power. You know, it comes down to raw power. And I think they have to play from that perspective. Depending on the United States for the last 75 years, has in fact weakened the alliance, not made it stronger.
When you talk of sheer power, of course, that's something that President Trump is very aware of, too. Do you see his use of American power, and I'm thinking of Venezuela, but also over Iran and potentially in Iran again, as something that is useful in giving the Russians pause and making them think that there may be consequences for them down the line?
Well, I think the reason why Putin would pause with the use of American military power is simply how good we are. The fact is, we were able to penetrate all of the defenses in Iran. Those were Russian systems that we penetrated and were able to hit his targets and didn't lose a single aircraft. When you looked about what happened in Venezuela by using a special operations raid that went in there and got the leader of a country, got him out of there, the Cubans who put his self-defense force in place were basically annihilated. I think that sends a clear message. And the third part on that is when Putin went to Alaska and when we overflew B-2 bombers and F-35s, it shows that the preeminent military power is the United States of America. And we shouldn't be afraid of anybody, and we shouldn't be afraid to use it. And it just shows you with the military equipment that we have that we can basically go anywhere, do anything that we want to do. And I think when you take our assets, combine them with the allies, and a lot of the allies have bought American equipment, that just shows how powerful the Americans and the allies are.
You said earlier that the war would end. Along what lines do you think? Because that, of course, is another area of huge controversy. The idea that land will have to be given up. What's your view of that?
Look, go back to the Baltics from World War II, when Lithuania and when Estonia and when Latvia were all under Soviet control. We never said they were Soviet territory. We never recognized that they were. And when land is given up, hopefully it'll come back. I think you have to look to the future out there. And what they're really talking about, at least with Russia, you're talking about Luhansk, which is about 98% controlled, Donetsk, which is about 70% controlled, and Kherson and Zaporizhia. Those are the four oblasts. If you count Crimea, that's your five. And maybe there will be a loss of territory in the near term. I said near term. In the long term, as long as you end this conflict, allow everybody to reset, allow Ukraine to build up what they want to build up, which is 800,000 troops. That'll be the largest army in Europe. But as long as there's strong security guarantees from the United States and others, I think you can get away with that. It's hard to take, it's hard to say, but over the long term, is this what you want to do to end the war? And they're going to have to think hard about that, where they want to be.
General Keith Keller, thank you so much for talking to us.
It is 16 minutes to 8.
As we heard earlier, the government says it's going to release some documents relating to the appointment of Lord Mandelson as Britain's ambassador to the US. The Conservatives, of course, putting pressure on the government to make information about how he was vetted public. Some of that pressure as well, though, coming from within the Labour Party. In fact, there is real anger, it seems, among Labour MPs. Let us talk to Chris Mason, our political editor, who is on the line now. What can you tell us, Chris?
Yeah, morning to you, Justin. I think the gravity of what is alleged is pointing to an emerging political scandal that could build to perhaps one of the biggest now for a generation. And what's interesting in terms of the reaction within Labour is that most political rows or moments that attach the word scandal can be quite self-contained emotionally. This one is permeating, it is percolating out, particularly among Labour figures who feel, frankly, deeply let down, shaking with anger, as one put it to the BBC, who was around at the time, back in the late noughties, when Lord Mandelson was Gordon Brown's first Secretary of State. The way they're rationalising it is this. Yes, they knew that Lord Mandelson was a big personality. Yes, they knew he was a risky pick to send to Washington. He'd lost his job twice before over his dealings with rich men. But they say these emails, these pictures are on a whole other level, a colossal breach of trust. And, you know, remember, this would have been deeply serious, whoever this information had been shared with, let alone with a convicted paedophile. And of course, because of his appointment last year as ambassador to Washington, that gives this a salience now, a political salience now,
yeah,
that clearly it wouldn't have had he not got that job.
But are they also saying to you, Chris, that the job that should have been done in terms of vetting when he was appointed was not done, and that that was the fault of the number 10 operation?
There is some of that, and there is some spiky remarks about Morgan McSwinney, the Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister. There's also an acknowledgement from plenty of Labour MPs that if there wasn't a candour in that vetting process, then how much could you expect the system to dredge out, particularly, as Lord Mandelson has previously said, plenty of this information was sitting on computer servers that he no longer had access to and that he couldn't recall. As far as Mr. McSwinney is concerned, he is widely seen as being central to the appointment of Lord Mandelson to that job, and he is increasingly a lightning rod for Labour grumbles. But he's also recognised as the key architect in Labour's big election win, and in many senses, he's the keystone of the Starmer political project. So, were his departure to happen, either in the short term or as something perhaps after the May elections, he could leave the Prime Minister particularly exposed. I should say, as far as Lord Mandelson is concerned, he is not commenting publicly, but I understand that he maintains that he's not acted criminally, that he didn't act to further his own personal gain, and he will cooperate with the police.
If you take a step back, or even two steps back,
mm-hmm,
and you look at Lord Mandelson's contribution to Labour, it makes mm-hmm it almost, I mean, peculiarly extraordinary, doesn't it, as a scandal, given that he is one of the architects that many people in Labour think brought Labour back into a position where they could at least vie to be in power.
Yeah, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say he is one of the central figures of the Labour Party and the Labour movement of the last half century. There he was alongside Neil, now Lord Kinnock. He was a central figure in the development of the New Labour project. There he was in several senior jobs within Labour's time in government in the late 90s and the noughties. As I say, departed from two of them over rows involving rich men. Then a European commissioner. Then it was seen to be extraordinary when his career was revived and he came back in the most unlikely job to be Gordon Brown's number two as First Secretary of State in the late noughties. And then again, as ambassador to Washington, even though much was known, as I say, about his character, but at the same time, much was known, and his biggest internal critics acknowledge this, across politics, someone who was seen to be hugely, hugely able politically. That's why he continued to be rehired. What is different this time is the scale and depth of these revelations, which are on a different level from anything that went before, and that is what is prompting this huge sense of betrayal. That's the word that comes up again and again amongst so many figures within Labour, and why the government has felt compelled to say it will release this additional information around the vetting process, because Labour MPs were in no mood to be seen to be resisting the demands of the Conservatives and others.
Chris Mason, thank you. We'll be talking to Wes Streeting 10 past 8.
11 minutes to 8 right now, and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James Piccadilly.
Good morning. A new musical based on the book by Susan Wacoma opens tomorrow in the church I currently serve in London, telling the story of a remarkable and creative coincidence. In the late 1960s, one of the most prodigiously talented electric guitarists of the 20th century, a young Jimi Hendrix, lived in a flat in Brook Street, close to St James's. He spent his nights performing gigs in the clubs, developing a revolutionary sound, fusing blues, rock, R&B and psychedelia, composing melodic lead solos and chaotic, distorted soundscapes. Along the way, he influenced a generation of musicians across the world. 200 years earlier, In the same street, in the house next door, George Frederick Handel lived and composed, amongst other pieces, his most famous, Messiah. A master of the dramatic and emotional, Handel was equally at home, setting religious texts or telling complex human stories. That Jimi Hendrix and George Frederick Handel lived next door to each other, separated by two centuries and one thin wall, is the starting point for the new play, which imagines their encounter in their home through the eyes of a young Londoner who is experiencing homelessness herself. Playfully described by the National Youth Theatre as a musical that fuses baroque and roll, this imagined conversation highlights the belief held by many musicians that music is in itself a language of the spirit and in all its forms can express the deepest realities of what it is to be human, reaching for what's beyond, seeking the divine. In his short life, Jimi Hendrix described his hope that he was creating what he called electric church. "We're playing our sound to go inside the soul of a person," he said, "to awaken them, because there are so many sleeping people." One of Handel's most famous arias, written in that house on Brook Street, set the biblical text from St. Paul. "The trumpet shall sound," he wrote, "and the dead shall be raised." Music quickens the spirit, awakens the soul, often tears down the emotional scaffolding we've carefully constructed around our hearts, and opens us again to both the beauty and horror of the world as it is. The story of Handel and Hendrix reminds me that as we human beings live through time, we're surrounded by the echoes of the past, and are, as the saying goes, living today the future that someone else hoped for. Time itself is less linear than circular in this sense. Time is, in the concept beloved of physicists, what stops everything from happening at once. In the Christian tradition, the music that's made on earth is but an echo of the music made in heaven. So eternity is close, and it's music that takes us there.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkert. It brings us to 8 minutes to eight.
The trumpets and the costumes may have to wait until Friday, the official opening of the Winter Olympics, but the games themselves kick off today in Milan Cortina in Italy. 3,500 athletes are converging for snow and ice-bound competition. The skiing and bobsleighing always elicit admiration as well as some astonishment and fierce competition, but the real excitement often surrounds the hypnotically engaging business of pushing a heavy polished lump of rock over ice and, of course, furiously sweeping in front of it as it travels. Curling is the sport and Britain is terribly good at it. The men are reigning world champions. The women have European silver. Here's how the executive performance director of British Curling, Nigel Hole, described Team GB's success in the event 4 years ago.
To come away with a gold medal and a silver medal in 2022 after the challenges of the pandemic, where we had no medals in 2018. So that's a significant step up. You've got Eve Muirhead in her fourth Olympic Games, finally carrying off a very shiny gold medal with a team around her who've never been to an Olympic Games. And you've got the men's team, Bruce Mowat and the boys, playing a stunning competition and an incredibly high quality final and just being pipped by the Swedes. The answer is very satisfied with that.
Well, Vicky Wright was a gold medalist at the last Olympics in curling. One is now one of the BBC commentary team in Cortina. Vicky Gosling is team leader at GB Snow Sports. Good morning to you both. Vicky, let's start more broadly about winter sports. There is something about it that leaves you on the edge, isn't there? It is different from other competitions.
Absolutely. I think every 4 years we get the chance to watch these sports that we don't see regularly on TV. Yeah. And it just grasps the nation every time. And I think this Olympics is going to be no exception.
Vicky Gosling, I'm going to have to go with you on your last names because you're both Vicky, forgive me. There is a thin line between the confidence you need and the arrogance that might trip you up. And I think you thought last time Team GB were on the wrong side of that line.
Yeah, I think, you know, we went into to Beijing and we'd had some fantastic results. You know, Charlotte Banks, world champion, Dave Riding, first time with a gold medal on the podium in Kitzbühel, and James Woods as well as a world champion. We also had, you know, Izzy Atkin coming in, previous Olympian. So it was, we were, you know, sort of hoping for some really strong results, albeit COVID and Brexit clearly were slightly distracting. But yeah, and I think potentially that that led to a little bit of complacency, and that's when you miss key indicators.
Right, Vicky Wright. I need to talk about curling. We need to talk about curling. It is hypnotic to watch. I have to say, I still don't understand what makes a great curler and why Britain is up there.
I think for curling, it's a very small and niche sport. Right. And all of us in Scotland are quite often tied by family roots to playing it. And you start at such a young age that we just get into it and we're very good at it. And we've got excellent training facilities now in Stirling, that's well supported by the National Lottery and UK Sport. And we've just really managed to hone in on being good at something, and I've figured out the secret to winning.
What is the secret to winning?
I think for us, we're very much, it's fit. The training's changed over the years and we became a professional sport. Go back 10 years ago, it was just a new thing, the new concept of training, more gym work, more time on ice.
Right.
And over the last 10 years, that's definitely developed and all the athletes now are full time and dedicate their lives to doing it.
Vicky Gosling, I mean, more broadly, the Winter Olympics, is a medal haul a somewhat curious ambition for a country that is not exactly snowbound? I mean, the old gag of the Jamaican bobsleigh team springs to mind.
Well, I think that might have been the way that people perceived Britain, but that I think the reality is, you know, we have now, if you look at the results we've had, even just the X Games that have just happened, we've come away with three gold medals in three different disciplines. And Britain's gone from being a bit of an underdog to a serious contender on the world snow sports stage. I think that's fair to say. It's not sort of sporadic podiums. It's actually continual over, you know, we've seen this with World Cups. We've seen it in the World Championships. And we're really proud that we're now in a position where across Paralympic and Olympic disciplines, you know, we've had over 10 world champions. So I think we are actually no longer just happy to be at the start line, but we genuinely have become a serious contender now.
Well, the start line is where we are at for this Winter Olympics. Vicky Wright, Vicky Gosling, enjoy the festival. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Next week, a new series explores the rise of weight loss medications.
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new five-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo. Next Monday to Friday, lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
2 minutes to eight. Let's find out what joys the weather has in store for us. Darren Bett.
Thank you, Johnny. Well, it's not going to be as cold today. There will be a southeasterly breeze that will be picking up, and that's going to be blowing the wet weather that we've got slowly northwards. But across Wales, the Midlands and southern England, for the most part, it's going to be dry today. There is still some mist and fog around, mind you. It is slowly lifting. The clouds should break a little to allow some places to see some welcome sunshine come the afternoon, and it will be milder temperatures, reaching 10 or 11 Celsius. Move further north into northern England and Northern Ireland, and we've got some wet weather around this morning, some sleet and snow over the hills of northern England. It is going to move northwards, so it should be dry in the afternoon, but still cloudy, temperatures 7 degrees. It's in Scotland that we'll see most of the snow falling to some quite low levels for a while, so some difficult travelling conditions for a while, but the snow will lift more onto the hills and mountains, with most places seeing some light rain or drizzle into the afternoon. The breeze picking up, and it will be chillier here, temperatures 4 or 5 Celsius.
Darren, thank you. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Justin Webb.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of February. The headlines this morning: Downing Street has responded to Conservative pressure and anger on Labour's backbenchers by agreeing to release some information about Lord Mandelson's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has moved to the Sandringham estate just over 3 months after being told he would have to leave his home in Windsor. The NHS in England has been set a target of ensuring that by 2035, three quarters of patients diagnosed with cancer survive for 5 years or more.
And coming up in the next hour, what's life like for families in freezing Ukraine? No electricity to heat homes. We will hear from one family in Kyiv.
Now we have very big problem with electricity. We don't have heating in our homes. So such condition not for life in general.
And for some light relief.
Isn't it wonderful being back in the theatre and giving the people what they truly want?
I can't believe they're doing the old show again.
Well, if it ain't broke.
No, they are broke. That's why they're doing it.
The Muppet Show back after 45 years. Why? We'll hear from one of the original puppeteers. The news is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The government is to release some documents relating to its decision to appoint Lord Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to Washington after further revelations about his links to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Their publication isn't expected to happen immediately. The Conservatives have been pushing for more details about the vetting process. Lord Mandelson was appointed to the role this time last year before being sacked in September. The Metropolitan Police is to investigate allegations that when he was business secretary in 2009, he shared market-sensitive information with Epstein. Here's our political correspondent Harry Farley.
These documents concern Sir Keir Starmer's decision to resurrect Peter Mandelson's career and send him to Washington. The Conservatives have tabled a rare parliamentary motion known as a humble address to try to force the release of information. They want all papers relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment published, details of his vetting for the role, and communications between him and officials, including the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. Such is the anger at Peter Mandelson, it was clear that many Labour MPs would not have been willing to oppose the Tory motion had the government tried to vote it down. Instead, the Prime Minister has amended it, agreeing to publish the documents apart from those deemed prejudicial to national security or international relations. As for Lord Mandelson, he will now face questioning from Scotland Yard as part of an investigation into allegations of misconduct in public office. He has not commented publicly on the latest developments, but is understood to believe he did not act criminally, nor did he act to gain personally, and he will cooperate with the police.
The Labour MP Clive Efford has said there's a lot of bitterness on the backbenches and called the scandal the most serious since the Profumo affair in the 1960s. The Conservative Party chairman, Kevin Holleraker, told this programme that the situation risked undermining the whole of politics.
What the Prime Minister must do is make sure all this information is revealed. And it may be embarrassing to Keir Starmer personally, it may be embarrassing to the government, but that's a side issue right now. What's really important is we restore people's faith in the world of politics.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has moved from his home in Windsor to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk. Buckingham Palace announced last October that he would no longer be allowed to live at Royal Lodge following revelations then linked to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. There have been more in recent days. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was last seen in public on Monday. He was pictured on a horse ride close to his former home in Windsor, and was then seen driving from the castle, waving at passers-by. We now know that on Monday evening, as further revelations emerged around his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, he left Windsor for good and made the move to his new base on the Sandringham estate. His permanent home will be Marsh Farm, but that property is currently undergoing renovations, so he'll stay temporarily at Wood Farm, a property previously used by his father, Prince Philip. Sandringham is owned privately by the King, and he will pay the costs of his brother's new home. Thames Valley Police also say they are assessing information following claims Jeffrey Epstein sent a woman to Royal Lodge in 2010 for a sexual encounter with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The woman's lawyer has told the BBC she spent the night with the former prince and was then given a tour of Buckingham Palace. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has not responded to the allegations. He has always denied any wrongdoing.
Ministers are promising that far more patients diagnosed with cancer will survive for 5 years or longer by 2035. The pledge is included in a new 10-year cancer plan for the NHS in England. Charities have welcomed the government's ambitions, but some experts have expressed doubt about whether the targets are realistic. More from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A key cancer target in England is that 85% of patients should begin their treatment within 62 days of an urgent referral, but this hasn't been met since 2014. Currently, 70% hit that goal. Ministers say this will now be achieved by March 2029, along with two other targets, one covering rapid diagnosis. The government says around 60% of patients currently survive 5 years or more, a lower rate than in Poland and Romania for some cancers. The aim is to get this to 75% by 2035. The plan proposes investing more in scanners and digital technology to speed up diagnosis and more robot-assisted surgery. Cancer Research UK said this was a significant commitment. The Nuffield Trust think tank said the ambition was welcome, but the NHS would find the targets incredibly difficult to meet based on current performance.
Ukraine and Russia are due to take part in more peace talks in Abu Dhabi over the next 2 days. The negotiations are being coordinated by the United States. General Keith Kellogg has served as President Trump's envoy to Ukraine. He told this programme Russia wasn't strong and wasn't winning the fight. But the Ukrainians may have to consider giving up land in return for peace.
Maybe there will be a loss of territory in the near term. I said near term. In the long term, as long as you end this conflict, allow everybody to reset, allow Ukraine to build up what they want to build up, which is 800,000 troops. But as long as there's strong security guarantees from the United States and others, I think you can get away with that. It's hard to take, it's hard to say, but over the long term, is this what you want to do to end the war? And they're going to have to think hard about that, where they want to be.
At least 15 migrants have died after their speedboat collided with a Greek patrol vessel in the Aegean. Children and a pregnant woman are among the injured taken to hospital. The collision happened off the island of Chios near Turkey. A search has been taking place for people missing in the water. A review has recommended creating a new post at the heart of government to oversee criminal courts in England and Wales. The retired judge, Sir Brian Leveson, was asked by ministers to look at ways of reducing the unprecedented backlog of cases. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Sir Brian says his recommendations mustn't lead to a pick-and-mix job, and ministers, the police, judges and others must all act quickly. He wants a dedicated advisor answerable to the Prime Minister to oversee efficiency reforms across the fragmented justice system and more use of artificial intelligence tools to help prepare cases more quickly and judges to better schedule trials. The Law Society, which represents criminal solicitors, says the report underlines the need for more funding across the courts. Ministers are expected to respond to the proposals within weeks.
Rules on fostering are to be relaxed in England under plans to tackle a shortage of foster carers and create 10,000 more places for vulnerable children. Under the proposals, people who rent, are single or unmarried, work full-time or come from diverse backgrounds would be allowed to open their homes to children in care. The Children's Minister, Josh McAllister, says the current rules have pushed out families who could offer support.
The staggering thing is that we don't have a problem with people being interested in fostering. 150,000 people last year expressed an interest in fostering, but we only approved just over 7,000 of them. Now, that conversion drop-off is one of the big problems we're going to address through these reforms so that we can create the 10,000 extra places in fostering that children need.
The leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, has told the BBC documentary that his party is only halfway ready for power and that there's more work to do. He also claimed he never did anything serious when challenged about allegations he made racist and anti-Semitic remarks as a teenager at school. The programme is presented by Laura Koonsberg.
Reform has led the opinion polls for nearly a year, terrifying the traditional parties. But Nigel Farage told me his party was only halfway ready for power in 2029, despite being plagued by allegations of racist and anti-Semitic behaviour during his teenage years. He said he'd never worried that he might have upset anyone. Yet he said he was sorry if anyone had been genuinely hurt. Since last May, Reform's run 12 councils in England, its first taste of real power. But with several dozen councillors having to quit, Mr. Farage told me the trouble with political leadership was you actually became responsible for everything, an admission his opponents are likely to seize on.
Reform, Ready to Rule will be on BBC Two at 9 o'clock tonight and available to watch on the iPlayer.
Alan, thank you. 10 minutes past eight is the time. We should be talking about cancer today, and we will. The government is announcing ambitious targets for cancer treatment in England and has admitted very openly that the current position is often very poor, poorer than in comparable countries. But, of course, the headlines are dominated once again by the staggering suggestions that Lord Mandelson, while he was a government minister, shared highly sensitive information with his friend, the sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein. Shared it sometimes on a minute-by-minute basis. And when Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister at the time, complained last year to the Cabinet Secretary about the leaks he thought he'd detected, no information of relevance could be found. In the Commons today, there's going to be an effort to get all the information published that led to the appointment of Peter Mandelson as US ambassador at the end of 2024. The government says it will publish what it can. Meanwhile, Peter Mandelson himself faces a police investigation. He says he'll cooperate. And as we heard in the news, he is suggesting that he did not act criminally and did not personally benefit from the leaking. Let us talk now to Wes Streeting, the health secretary, who is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Peter Mandelson has been a friend of yours, hasn't he? Is he still?
No. And look, whether or not his behaviour has met a criminal threshold is for the police to decide. But what we've seen in recent days in relation to the leaking of highly confidential, highly sensitive, potentially market-sensitive information is so jaw-droppingly stupid and outrageous that I don't need a copy of the ministerial code in front of me or a copy of the law in the land to know that what he did could not have been done with any reasonable explanation or justification. And what we have seen, not just in the release of this set of Epstein files, but in the previous release, is evidence there in black and white of a gross betrayal of two prime ministers, of our country's national interest, of Epstein's victims, those women and girls who were not believed as they campaigned for justice. And it's a betrayal of our values, which is why, although there is outrage universally across the political spectrum and outrage from people up and down the country, that outrage is felt acutely by those of us in the Labour Party who feel particularly let down because Peter Mandelson betrayed our values and is clearly not the person that people thought he was.
To which some of your colleagues will say, well, hang on a second, we always said that about him. And there were those in the party, including you, who were minded to keep on trusting him in spite of all the evidence that there was that he was not to be trusted. So you, for instance, have on social media posed with him. You were very proud that he came to your constituency. I think you've now deleted those posts. In other words, there is a sense inside the party among Labour MPs, and we were hearing this earlier in the programme, who say there is a group of people at the top of the party who trusted this man when they should not have done, and you're part of that group.
Well, I'll say a few things to that. I mean, firstly, as a Labour candidate in 2015, of course I was proud when former Labour cabinet ministers came to campaign for me.
And you have deleted that now, haven't you?
Yeah, for a very simple reason, that those photos contained other people in. One photo of my mother, and in the case of other photos, people who were just volunteers turning out to help me in the Labour Party. And I think it is totally fair for you to ask me and other elected representatives questions about Peter Mandelson, his conduct and our reaction to it. And it's totally legitimate for people to share posts I've written on social media in praise of Peter Mandelson, which are still there, by the way, for transparency. But of course, I took action to protect other people who are not elected representatives. So I just want to make that clear. And secondly, on this question of judgment and the appointment of Peter Mandelson as our US ambassador, Peter Mandelson was appointed to that job because of his experience as a senior government minister, as business secretary, his experience as an EU trade commissioner, and his political experience. And the combination of those skills were felt to be needed in Washington at a time where our relationship with the US is particularly sensitive and important, particularly on trade, and where there's a backdrop of global instability. And during the vetting process, Peter Mandelson was asked about his relationship with Epstein. We now know through the previous release of information that the Prime Minister was not given a full and accurate picture. And we know that because when the last tranche of information was released, the Prime Minister sacked him immediately, making sure he was woken up in the middle of the night and put on a plane back to London and left office in disgrace. And now what we've seen in the latest tranche of information is not just a betrayal of Keir Starmer as our current Prime Minister, but a betrayal of Gordon Brown, who, with Alistair Darling, was doing everything he could to get our country through,
not just
a national, but a global economic crisis,
if there had been
at a time when
vetting,
someone close to him was leaking information in a way that could never be justified or excused.
If there had been proper vetting, part of that vetting would have been to say to the American Department of Justice, which had all of this material, is there anything you've got on this guy before we appoint him? That should have happened, shouldn't it?
Well, that's something that for the Cabinet Secretary to look at, because the Prime Minister is opting for full transparency.
But should it have happened?
We don't know what requests were made,
but should those requests have been made?
Candidly, Justin, I don't know how these vetting processes are conducted, and that is one of the things the Prime Minister will inevitably
because
want to look
at. Because it seems that
at.
They just went to Peter Mandelson, said, what do you think about your relationship, and then left it at that. That would not be enough if that is all that happened, would it?
Well, that's speculation on your part. You weren't involved in the vetting process. Neither was I. I haven't seen the process.
No,
I
but what I'm asking
what
you
was
is,
gone
should
that's
more
why
have
by
happened?
The, that's why, the by point. The way, the Prime Minister is opting for transparency in this case. He's drawn a very clear line. So the Prime Minister's been very clear. He will publish the information relating to Peter Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador. The exceptions to that will be anything that compromises our national security and security services and their work, and anything that could undermine our international relations. But short of that bar, which I think most reasonable people would understand, he's opting for transparency. And what we've seen in recent days also is a Prime Minister acting rapidly to make sure that Peter Mandelson is stripped of all of the titles and privileges that were conferred on him through public service.
Are you seriously saying this morning, I take that point, but are you seriously saying this morning that none of this goes to the Prime Minister's judgment? That the judgment is that the Prime Minister himself is home free when it comes to questions about his judgment, because the efforts were made to investigate Peter Mandelson's past. Those efforts were rebuffed by Peter Mandelson himself, or he didn't come clean about all that happened, and that is enough. That's it.
Well, I think we need transparency on the vetting process. So does the Prime Minister. That's why that transparency will be given. Most of the rest of what you've just said, with respect, Justin, is speculation, because you haven't seen the vetting, I haven't seen the vetting, you're not aware of the process that was followed, and neither am I. That is why the Prime Minister is opting for transparency. And that is why he is also and has been throughout this acting rapidly. When the first tranche of Epstein information came to light, the Prime Minister was clear then that he had not been given the full picture and that he had not been told the whole truth. And that is why the Prime Minister sacked him.
The Prime Minister of Poland has suggested that Epstein might have been a Russian spy. Do we have to accept that that is at least a possibility?
Well, I'm not in a position to comment on that this morning. I do think we need to look seriously at Epstein's connections and in whose interest he was acting. And by the way, the other point I want to make, which I think is particularly important, because while there is rightly scrutiny on Mandelson's conduct as a government minister and his role in all of this, we mustn't also lose sight of the fact that at the heart of this scandal are the people who have the right to be most angry, which are the women and girls who suffered at the hands of Epstein, some of the most serious and monstrous crimes, some of whom did not live to see justice and to be vindicated. And of course, we've never seen justice properly served on Epstein for all of his crimes while he was still alive. And we mustn't lose sight of that, because at the heart of that is, I'm afraid, the blunt truth in all of this, which is that the reason why Epstein got away with this for so long was because he was powerful, because he was wealthy, and because he was well connected. And I think there are serious questions to be asked about that in relation to his victims, those girls, those women who were not believed even after they'd had the courage to come forward. But then there are also that wider set of questions.
But
what were his other international
relationships? But hang on a second.
On
the women and girls, because you bring up a hugely important point, obviously. On the women and girls, they then saw Britain appoint as its US ambassador a man who had been immensely pally with Jeffrey Epstein, because that was already known, wasn't it, when he was appointed as ambassador. So in the light of that, and in the light of what you've just said about the women and girls, can you not accept now that at the very least that was poor judgment on the part of the Prime Minister?
Well, we took a view, and we take a view generally, that we don't make people guilty by association. And assurances were sought through the vetting process about Mandelson's relationship with Epstein, and the Prime Minister wasn't told the whole truth about it. And look, I understand the questions, and you asking reasonable questions, so I'm not challenging that. But we also mustn't let Peter Mandelson off the hook here. It was his judgment, his misconduct, that's at the heart of this. The Prime Minister has every right to feel betrayed and let down and misled, as does Gordon Brown, as does our whole country, frankly. And yes, you are right. Most importantly of all, those women and girls who were victims of Epstein have every right to feel let down too. And I am extremely sorry for those women and girls for what they have suffered through and what they continue to suffer through. And the fact that there are brave women like Virginia Giuffre who never lived to see real justice. And that is the greatest tragedy of all.
Just a final thought on this. Harriet Harman on the programme yesterday was saying the problem with all of this is that people tend to say all politicians are the same. And this feeds into that. And you accept that. And I think the Prime Minister accepts it as well. The problem is that in a sense, I mean, a matter of degree is different, but in a sense, when they look at the scandal that came right at the beginning of Labour coming to power, the Prime Minister had accepted money for clothing and all the rest of it, and albeit that most of it was declared, perhaps declared wrongly and then redeclared. But just the idea that people in politics tend to get close to wealthy outsiders who can provide the kind of funding for a lifestyle that they themselves can't afford. That is a problem, isn't it? And it's not just a problem about Peter Mandelson.
Well, there is a challenge about money in politics generally, because in this country we do not have state funding of political parties. Parties do have to raise money for campaigns and costs. And so there is always that importance of transparency, of probity, and of strong safeguards and protections. Partly that's about transparency. And I think, to be fair to our political system, we do have transparency in relation to political donations. I think it's totally reasonable for people to ask about greater transparency. For example, in this world of cryptocurrency, is it right people can donate using crypto? I think those are big questions. But then there are also rail guards in terms of how ministers conduct themselves, which is why I can, you know, say and feel very strongly about the fact that what we have seen there in black and white through Peter Mandelson's misconduct is extremely serious, because it's so blindingly obvious that you don't do that. And part of the anger that we all feel, I think, in politics is that risk of plague on all your houses, when most people in most political parties are in public life because they believe in public service. We might disagree about how to get the best for our country. That is the terrain on which democratic politics is fought. But I genuinely think, when I go to work in the House of Commons, that most people on those benches, whichever side of the chamber they're on, are in it for the right reasons. That is why politicians are so angry about this Mandelson business, because it does reflect badly on politics. Yeah. And it is why those of us in the Labour Party in particular feel so bitterly betrayed, because it is a betrayal of our values and what motivates us in politics. And, you know, and that's before we get to my mild frustration, albeit absolute acceptance, that so far this entire interview has been about Peter Mandelson and not about the National Cancer Plan that's going to save lives over the next decade. But look, that's the cross I have to bear, unfortunately, and it's not a criticism of the Today programme. And I'm grateful you're at least giving me some questions on cancer this morning, because poor Karen Smith had to answer questions about Mandelson yesterday morning and, again, conveyed just how angry we all are in the Labour Party about
this. Okay, and I mean, it's not just that you want to talk about cancer, it's that people with cancer and all of us want to talk about it as well. That's the point, isn't it? It's not just about something derailing the government, it's about something derailing all of our national life, which, of course, we were promised would not happen, in fairness. We were told that we were going to go back to being grown up and governed in a grown-up manner and all the rest of it, and it hasn't necessarily happened. But so it's not the fault of you, it's not the fault of us, and it's not the fault of the people listening to this programme, is it? It's the fault of someone else. Let us talk a bit about cancer. One of the things we were hearing earlier in the programme is that, yes, this is a really positive thing, the targets you're coming out with today, but it will only actually work, and I think you're going to accept that it will only work if there is the resourcing to back it. So tell us a bit about the resourcing that there is going to be.
Yes, so it's a 10-year cancer plan, and we want to make sure that by 2035, three-quarters of people diagnosed with cancer survive. That is a big shift from where we are today, which is lagging behind the rest of Europe. But the good news is we won't have to wait a decade to see progress. In fact, by the end of this parliament, we want to see the NHS achieving the standards we should have always been meeting for cancer but haven't met for over a decade, whether that's the faster diagnosis standard of receiving a diagnosis or all clear within 28 days. Good news, we are already meeting that as a new government. But where we've got much more to do is not just to maintain that, but to also make sure people are receiving treatment and within 62 days of being referred, where we are some way off. And we'll do that by investing over £2 billion in diagnostic technology.
Which will come from where?
Well, that's come through the extra investment the Chancellor has given the NHS. She's consistently prioritised the NHS in the budget and the spending review. That will enable us to deliver an extra 9.5 million diagnostic tests and scans over the course of this parliament. And we're also investing £6 billion in cancer care, which will include things like the robotic surgery, the Da Vinci robot, for example, that saved my life when I went through kidney cancer. That's the progress we'll make in this parliament. The big game changer, by the way, as well as in the quality of service, will also be the breakthroughs in science. Over the next decade, I think we're going to be in a world where we can not only diagnose earlier and treat faster, but potentially predict and prevent cancer through a combination of genomics and also potentially the kind of cancer vaccines that some of our scientists are really excited about. So I think there's lots to be confident and optimistic about in terms of the future. But I know from, you know, my own experience as a cancer survivor, and also from the different, and I'm afraid in the case of a friend of mine who passed away last week, fatal experiences of people with cancer, that at the moment, cancer care in this country is too much of a lottery. I'm lucky, one of the lucky ones, I've survived. My friend Nathaniel Dye, who died last week, died with stage 4 bowel cancer. And the tragic truth is, I survived because the NHS was there for me when I needed it. Nat has died because he was diagnosed far too late. That is the life and death difference that we can make if the NHS is there for us when we need it. And that is the thing that puts fire in my belly as a cancer survivor, to make sure that more people have outcomes like mine and people are not grieving avoidable tragic loss because the NHS didn't reach them in time.
Wes Streeting, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
It's 27 minutes past eight. The big news of the day is, of course, the return of the Muppets. A brand new special episode lands on Disney Plus, a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the original series that made Kermit and Miss Piggy and the fabulous grumpy old men, Statler and Waldorf, made all of them part of growing up. Here is a taste of the new episode.
It's time to get things started. The most sensational, inspirational celebration.
We're still working out a few kinks.
Oh, that's all right. I love a kink.
Hola!
This is what we call a Muppet Show!
I can't believe they're doing the old show again.
Well, if it ain't broke.
No, they are broke. That's why they're doing it!
Boom! Some of the trailer for the new episode of The Muppet Show on Disney Plus. I'm joined by Nina Conti, comedian and puppeteer. She's down the line. Louise Gold here in the studio, puppeteer and voice actress for The Muppet Show for four seasons from 1977 onwards. Louise, let me start with you. Can you believe they're doing it again?
Just listening to the news and that last thing, which made me want to cry about the state everything is in. It's just what we need. Oh, my God, do we need some laughs?
Take us back to when you joined. You joined after the first series,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes.
Take us back to how that was.
Well, I was 20 and I was shortly out of drama school and doing tours of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Land of the Dinosaurs. I'd never done any puppeteering, and they were auditioning tall women.
Right.
So I have no skill other than being tall, the miracle of height, which had kept me out of a lot of other jobs because I was always too tall, because young people in television are very short.
Right.
You can only be tall once you're over 20. So I auditioned for Jim Henson at a desk. I didn't really know what the Muppet Show was. I said, I've never done any puppeteering. He said, that's okay. Nobody does what we do. We'll teach you. And I did some silly voices, and they tried three women out, and I was the mad one that they kept on. I think I had some anarchic spirit that made me fit in, and I've been working with them on and off ever since.
I think that anarchic spirit lives on. Nina Conti, what was it that caught your imagination about this show in amongst all the other shows that there were around at that time?
Well, they're just absolutely lovable, and yeah, they are anarchic, but they're also sort of intelligent. There's a dignity about all of them. They're very adult personalities, but they appeal to everybody. And yeah, like you were saying, it's just what we need. It's something that nobody's going to argue with that. Everybody loves the Muppets, I think. Hopefully everyone. I don't know everyone, but I mean, it's a joining area of life. People, whatever political opinion or whatever, you got the Muppets. It's just kind of, it's a balm.
You take inspiration from the show.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually don't use one of those sort of ventriloquist mannequins because of the Muppets, because when I was learning ventriloquism, I thought, oh, good, does this renegade me into having to have one of these creepy things? And then I thought, no, of course not. I could have something like a Muppet. And that would be much more fun. So that's kind of, yeah, a huge inspiration.
Louise, do you remember your parts?
Of course I do.
Well, I share it with the rest of the class.
I was a singing tomato.
Oh, well, who'd forget that?
How can you forget? A Big Mama, one of the big monsters. My favourite moment was doing a Royal Variety performance. Prince Charles walking along the lineup. Then the most eligible bachelor in the world. And him saying, are there any women in the Muppets? And I leapt at him. Prince, Prince, Prince. Also, my character was called Annie Sue Pig, and all the Muppet characters are taken from the souls of the performers. They're all split personalities. They're all our essences. And I didn't realise this at the time, but mine was a very young, ambitious pig who worshipped Miss Piggy, but was obviously a great rival to her, and incredibly talented. I don't know where they got that from.
Nina, the format, the show within a show format, gives it great flexibility, doesn't it? I mean, both the sort of anarchy, which Louise has been discussing, but also this ability to switch from in front of the stage to behind.
It really does. And I think it's clever because I've always found that puppets have got a bit of a problem with the fourth wall. They see through it. So if you put them in a show context, that's easier. They can talk right down the lens. I mean, you can't... when I work with puppets, they can't sort of act like they're in a play, like there's no one there. They've always got a little hand reaching through that fourth wall, and so it's kind of perfect for them. It's also kind of meta, I suppose, which suits them down to the ground. Well, so like when something is so fantastical like a puppet, the more grounded in the truth of the thing, like we're putting on a show, it just sort of sells it much better.
There has been discussion about whether or not the cast within this studio are actually real people or Muppets themselves. I think you've got some thoughts on that.
No, I haven't got any thoughts. Your researcher gave me a list and told me, because I'd never met any of you, so I haven't got a clue. But I wanted one of you to be the Muppet newsman because things always fell on his head, which I really like the idea of that. And the researcher suggested Sam the Eagle. Justin, you might be Sam the Eagle.
I think that's a compliment, Justin.
Underneath his feathers was naked. Although he was...
Aren't we all?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I did, in a previous job, work on Radio 2 Breakfast and meet the Cookie Monster when he came in
as a
guest on Zoe Ball's show. And it was amazing to watch the puppeteer under the table with the Cookie Monster. And with the fun fact I learned, he has his own brand of cookies. It has to be very destructible cookies. There can't just be any off-the-shelf cookies.
There was a puppeteer under the table.
Yes, usually.
Completely I've done... blown it.
Sorry.
It was a real thing.
But you know the most amazing thing... When I first got the job, I went to the studio and thought, oh, this is going to take the magic away. I'll see them. And it's even more magic when you see grown men with their arms up in the air and you are looking at the puppets and they disappear. And that's even more magic.
Magic all round. Thank you very much. Nina Conti, Louise Gold, lovely to have you in the studio today. Thank you.
just after nine. Sideways is going to be here. Here's Matthew Side with the details.
Here's something you may not know about me. I grew up in a family and a community that believed deeply in miracle healings. Now, I don't believe in that anymore, but this morning on Sideways, we hear from a neuroscientist who interprets his inexplicable recovery from cancer as evidence of divine intervention. And we question whether miracles can ever be compatible with scientific thinking. Join me, Matthew Side, for Sideways, this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather. Spells of rain and hill snow in the north, but bright spells, sunshine even, developing in southern areas. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Justin Webb. It is 25 to 9. Let's have a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Number 10 is to release some of the files related to the appointment of Lord Mandelson as Britain's ambassador to the US. This follows revelations that he shared sensitive data with Jeffrey Epstein while serving as a cabinet minister in 2009. Police are investigating. It's understood that Lord Mandelson believes he had not acted criminally. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting told us that the latest tranche of Epstein files demonstrates a gross betrayal of two prime ministers as well as the UK's national interests. Mr. Streeting said Keir Starmer was opting for transparency by releasing documents about Lord Mandelson's appointment as ambassador. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has moved out of his home in Windsor to the Sandringham estate. Thames Valley Police is assessing allegations that a second woman was sent to the UK by Epstein for a sexual encounter with the former prince in 2010. Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor has previously denied wrongdoing. The government has promised to increase cancer survival rates as part of a 10-year plan to tackle the disease in England. Some charities have welcomed the strategy, while others have called for more investment. And Ukraine and Russia are to resume peace talks in Abu Dhabi under the auspices of the US. Territorial concessions remain a key sticking point in the negotiations.
And at 24 minutes to 9, before we get on with the rest of the programme, Mike is here with the sport.
Justin, thank you. Let's talk more, shall we, about the Winter Olympics, because the opening ceremony is on Friday. But as we've been hearing already in this programme, the first action of these games gets underway today. The mixed doubles curling starts this evening, with British medal hopes once again resting on the pair who finished fourth at the last games, Bruce Moat and Jen Dodds. Jen went on to win gold with the women's rink in China 4 years ago, whilst Bruce took silver with the men, but they have reunited for the mixed doubles, and I caught up with them earlier. They've been out in the mountains of Cortina for the last few weeks now, and started by setting the scene for us.
It's stunning views. We're in a valley in the village. The arena is very cool. We're obviously looking forward to playing with hopefully packed stands, and yeah, just very excited to get going now.
You want to reach to get here in the best possible position to be in. And I feel for the mixed doubles, I think the men's and women's were all in a pretty good position. And I think we're all just really excited to get going.
And Jen, you are returning to these games as Olympic champion. How is that a different prospect, I wonder, to the other games that you prepared for in China? Because this time, of course, you are the title holder. You are the ones to beat this year. Is that a different prospect?
It's nice to come back as Olympic champion. Like growing up, that was the dream, was winning an Olympic gold and achieving that. It was amazing. So having the opportunity to go back for your second, it's just sort of continuing the dream, isn't it?
But has it been harder to prepare mentally for these games, Jen, when, if you're honest, I'm sure you would admit that you achieved your lifelong dream last time?
I think sort of the year after the Olympics, it was hard because you had this one goal since I was 8 years old that I wanted. So it was very much you needed to take time to sort of reassess the goals. And I still want to continue playing. Again, like mixed doubles, we finished fourth in Beijing. So I was like, right, that is a very big driver for me. I want to go back there.
Bruce, as far as the men's rink goes, there can be no greater motivation for you on the flip side, I guess. Silver last time out in Beijing. You are presumably in Cortina with one aim and one aim only, and that is to go one better this time.
Well, yeah, in the men's game, that's the plan. Like, we would love to come away with the Olympic gold. We obviously saw the girls do it last time. And yeah, it's a good motivation for us to come away with that gold. Like, the silver was a pretty cool achievement, but it wasn't what we were there for. And I think post games, we kind of regrouped really well. We've won the World Championships twice in the last 3 years. So that's putting us in a really good spot to hopefully go one better this time.
And it is the two of you who are really kicking things off 2 days before the opening ceremony even begins on Friday with the mixed doubles. Jen, as you say, fourth last time out in Beijing. What's the hope this time around?
We want to medal this time. I think we felt the heartbreak of coming fourth. And I said, I think we got silver at Worlds last season back in April. So we know when we kind of play our best, we are very much in the hunt for the medals. Mixed doubles is a very chaotic game, let's say. You're kind of never safe. So, yeah, we just know we need to play our best, do what we do best, and hopefully the results will speak for themselves.
This is your sport. It's your life, if you like. You've dedicated your whole career to this fantastic sport, and you've had great success at it, both of you. But for many people, curling is a sport that they dip in and out of, and if we're honest, is only really on people's radars for 2 weeks every 4 years. How does it feel to have your sport that you are so dedicated to and know inside out back in the national spotlight for its time to shine? And do you mind all these bandwagon jumpers who jump in and then suddenly get obsessed and pretend to be curling experts when for a lot of the time it's not really on their radar?
I love it. I think it's great. It's obviously, we love to get the spotlight for our sport. It's just very exciting to see how kind of crazy it gets. You know, it's quite fun for us because obviously we've tried our best to like figure out tactics, and like, you know, people watch it for 2 weeks and say, oh, you should have played this shot. And I'm like, well, maybe. I don't really know. I think we did what we thought was best. But yeah, it's very exciting that we get to have the spotlight for 2 weeks. And, you know, we're very excited for people to hopefully go and try the sport as well.
The thing about the curling is it's pretty much on the entirety of the game. So when's your downtime? When do you get to enjoy the games and actually just being an Olympian?
We get one day off, let's say. We might not have much time to go and see anything, but that's what we want. We want to do both disciplines. And once you're in it, you kind of forget about the other events. You keep up with the Team GB sort of athletes who are competing. So I'm just really excited to see how we get on.
As are we. Big thanks to Bruce Moat and Jen Dodds, who get underway in the mixed doubles curling at the Winter Olympics later this evening. You can watch that on the red button. Is curling coming home, Justin? Invented in Scotland hundreds of years ago, and it could be coming back.
I'm saying nothing. 18 minutes to nine is the time. Let's turn to Ukraine, because there's been a combined missile and drone strike, a set of them, really, in Kyiv, in other locations as well, delivering what the energy company there calls the most powerful blow so far this year. And the attack coming after a so-called energy truce that had been agreed by Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin expired at the weekend, and the situation for ordinary people trying to carry on their lives, particularly in Ukraine's cities, is just deeply miserable. I've been talking to Irina Vuk, who is a mother. She works as a psychologist. She lives in Kyiv. She's been telling me about the conditions that she and her daughter are forced to live in.
Now we have very big problem with electricity. We don't have heating in our homes. So such condition not for life in general.
How cold is it in your flat?
A room temperature is about 6 or 10 degrees. And I use warm bottles of water to sleep. I live with my daughter, my husband, military husband, yeah, and he is not with us. And we need to do something to stay safe, yes, in such conditions.
How does your daughter manage?
She is okay in general, like children. She tries to smile, yes, to live normal life, but it's not normal life. She cannot study normal. She cannot use online lessons. And moreover, yesterday evening, we had accident with electricity. And this accident was very huge. And we don't know even when we will have such electricity for some hours. And now I'm thinking that maybe in some days later, I must go to the village to my parents, because here in Kyiv, living is very awful.
What the Russians seem to be doing is trying to make life as unbearable as possible for people in Kiev, to try to do as much damage as they can to people like you. Will that succeed? Does it mean that you and other Ukrainians will eventually want to give up the war?
We want to stop all this, of course. But at the same time, Russia is really a huge aggressor. And we people want to stop the war in general, but we want that they stop fight with us.
What do the next few days hold for you, do you think? What is going to happen? Because it seems that the Russians are determined to stop electricity being available to you and to families like yours. And it is very, very cold, isn't it? What do you think the next few days will bring?
Yes, the next days can bring us that we will live in a more awful situation. Yes, and what we can do? Maybe we will live in the village, not in the city, because in the village to have some heating, yes, and to have water even, yes, because here in Kiev water is again problem.
There are peace talks going on in Abu Dhabi at the moment. Do you think there is any possibility that the Russians are about to agree to stop the war? Does it feel like that to you?
I don't know. I'm not sure. And I don't believe in that. I hope, but I don't believe.
Irina Vovk, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It is 14 minutes to nine. Reform UK says it has a new way to save pubs and cut the price of a pint. The money to cut VAT on hospitality, cut the duty on pints and scrap the employer's national insurance increase on hospitality would come from reinstating the two-child cap on child benefit, unless both parents are working and both parents are British born. A few moments ago, I spoke to Reform UK's Chief Whip and MP for Ashfield, Lee Anderson. I said that independent groups suggested that the cost of the VAT cut proposed would be around £5.5 billion and that giving the savings on reinstating the benefit cap were much smaller. The numbers did not add up.
Well, I would say that's absolute nonsense. Zero and his policy team have crunched the numbers. And here's the thing here. We're trying to save British businesses. If these businesses, if these pubs, if the hospitality businesses close, they won't reopen, and that will cost the Treasury even more money. So this is about increasing the prospects of British businesses, our pubs, our hospitality sector, and keeping them open, keeping them recruiting staff. They're paying tax and national insurance. And to suggest that by us trying to help our hospitality industry and keep these businesses open will actually cost the Treasury money is a complete nonsense.
I'm sure many people would support the aim of keeping pubs open, even if they don't agree with the way in which you're going to balance the books. But again, the cost of the two-child benefit cap is what, 2.5 to 3 billion?
Yeah.
You might save by reinstating that cap, and no one that we've spoken to agrees with your numbers for the cost of dropping the rate of VAT, let alone all the other things that you want to do, cutting beer duty and also changing the way that business rates would be introduced. Yeah. They say that it just doesn't add up. And well, making things add up is important, isn't it, for Reform
UK? To be honest with you, Johnny, we're not interested in who you've been talking to. We're more interested in who we've been talking to. And we've been talking to landlords and small businesses up and down the country. And every landlord that I speak to, whether it's in my own patch or around the country when I'm doing my tours with Reform UK, they appreciate, they want this VAT cut. That will be the difference between them keeping the doors open and closing their business. And the last thing that we want is for them to close their business and that pub then becomes derelict on the high street. It never reopens. It becomes a HMO or flats or whatever. This is not good for the British economy.
And the fact or the suggestion that these numbers don't add up.
Listen, Johnny, we can go on all day about the numbers. I'm not interested in the numbers that the BBC have sourced. You're hardly a bastion of truth at the BBC when it comes to things like this.
OK, let's talk about then the...
And make sure you play that bit in the clip as well.
I'm sure we will. Let's talk about the eligibility for extra benefits that would come about, the those who would stay within the child benefit system. You have suggested, I think, that the latest iteration of this, and I'm not being impolite because it has changed a wee bit from Nigel Farage's first statement, that... only British workers, couples who are in full-time work, British-born workers, would be eligible to get child benefit above the two-child cap. And you suggested that's only about 3,700 households. Is that correct? Am I quoting your numbers correctly?
Well, it's not even child benefit. Child benefit's a completely different benefit.
Sure, but we're talking about the two-child benefit cap, the way in which the number is held down at the moment. You're suggesting the only people who would be eligible for benefit above the two-child benefit cap is for children born to two British-born people who are in work. Is that correct?
These are the numbers that Zia Youssef and his policy team have produced for our policy document. So if Zia's produced that, I'm confident that them figures are correct.
OK, I mean, again, and we can go back and forth about this. I mean, a very large number of people suggest you have a significantly larger number of white British households where there are two earners.
What's the colour of somebody's skin got to do with it?
Well, it's a way of... It's a clumsy way.
You've just said white British households. Surely there's a hint of racism there.
Well, again, forgive me if I used a clumsy...
Will you play this clip?
We're going to run out of time already unless we can try and address the question.
That is about the
number of households that you think will still receive benefit and will therefore cost the exchequer.
And his policy team have crunched the numbers. They've been working on this document for ages, and I'm confident that they've got their figures right.
OK, you're confident in those numbers. Final question, if I may, and this is about the principle, which is that you are suggesting that non-British-born households or anyone who has a partner who is non-British-born would not be eligible for the extra money above the two-child benefit cap. The money is intended to lift children out of poverty. It's not intended to be something that is dependent upon parental status. You're fine about having a degree of discrimination between children who are born to British-born parents and children who are born to not British-born parents.
British citizens should not be funding foreign nationals for having more than two children. It's as simple as that. And by the way, I spoke to a parent last night here in Westminster who's got six children, and she's told me that she can live on her current benefits with the two-child benefit cap. And my final point is, some of these families, if they're not working, every time they have a child, it's an extra £3,450. Pay rise in their benefit packets. If you was working, you would have to have a pay rise of £5,000 a year for every additional child. That's not fair.
Mr. Anderson, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
8 minutes to nine is the time now. Might it be possible one day for people who are paralysed, whose brains are not connecting to their bodies anymore, to have those connections rebuilt? The 2026 Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering honours nine engineers whose work on neural interfaces is changing lives and promises to do much more. And Professor John Donoghue is one of the winners from Brown University in the United States. And he is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What is it that you have won for? What have you managed to do?
Well, our technology is cutting edge and still being developed, so it's still what's called investigational or experimental. But what we've shown is that you can put an implant into the brain, just a small chip that's resting near the surface of the brain, can pick up patterns of activity of thinking about moving, and those signals can be decoded and then converted into control signals. And so for a person who's paralyzed, that's had their brain disconnected from their body by a stroke or a spinal cord injury or a disease ALS or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis where there's degeneration in the nervous system, we've already shown, in fact, the first experiments were done 20 years ago now showing that a person with this device connecting their brain to a computer can control a computer just like you can control a computer mouse. And then in two other milestone experiments, I think the first was that we showed that a person who was totally paralyzed and actually unable to speak for many years was able to use those brain signals to control a robotic arm, to pick up a cup of water in the morning and drink her morning coffee with just using this robotic arm. And so now she wasn't dependent on anybody else. And so, and she hadn't moved anything in 8 years, and now she was able to feed herself. So we restored her dignity.
Could you eventually get to a situation where you are providing this kind of technical support for someone who could then be impossible to tell apart from someone who hadn't suffered that?
Yes, so that's paralysis. Exactly. As a, you know, a professor, we have lofty goals. And that's the loftiest goal. Our long-term goal was that, as someone on the pitch, a footballer on the pitch kicking, you know, that you wouldn't be able to recognize that they had had a spinal cord injury or a stroke. This is a very ambitious goal. I think it's still a long way off, but it would be that's our ambition, is to make
that
a
is
system.
Where this leads.
Yes, it will. Yes, I'm convinced. We know we can do it. One of the big breakthroughs was that the brain is still working quite fine when many years after a destruction like a stroke or something, a spinal cord injury. And that was rather surprising to us. We thought the brain would change in some way that would make it impossible to make any sense of the activity in the brain. But that's not true. So we know that that's very well established now.
Professor John Donoghue, one of the winners of the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
8:58, the government's planning to provide 10,000 new foster care places for vulnerable children in England, but there is a critical shortage of foster carers. Why? Do we need more advertising, or do we need foster carers to encourage one another to join? Elaine Brown is the foster carer of a 12-year-old boy in Bristol. Good morning.
Good morning.
Did you do it, and how did you find it? How do you find it?
Yeah, so actually it was a neighbour. We were talking about what she was thinking of doing, fostering. So I said to her, so how easy is it to get involved in this? I said, because I'm single, so I don't think I would really fit the criteria. Yeah. And she said, actually, you would. And she said she knows, she's got a friend who's been a foster carer for this particular agency for over 20 years. And she said, I'm going to make arrangements to bring you around there. You can talk to her, ask her any kind of questions. So I went around there and I listened to her and I talked and I even saw the children who she was fostering coming down and interacting with her. And I thought, my gosh, this looks so lovely. The energy was just good. And what really made me think I can do this is that, yeah, it didn't matter if you're single, you're on your own, you know, they welcome you same way. So I thought, right, I'm going to get into this. So they recommended me. Somebody from the agency came round and spoke with me. And then I started the assessment. It's something, the assessment took about, I think, 5-6 months. They go through every aspect of your life, but they just want to make sure you're the right person for this role because you're looking after somebody's child, you know. Yeah. And I've been doing it for 3 years now. It's my first foster child and it has been great. One thing I absolutely love, I'm not alone. I can call the agency 24/7, 24 hours a day. There's somebody you can talk to at all times. You're not alone.
Elaine, it's fascinating hearing you talking as a single person as well, because I think a lot of people think, gosh, if I'm not in a sort of traditional family, I'm just not eligible. Is this part of the problem? Because the government has said it wants to encourage more single people, people from more diverse backgrounds. Is this part of the problem for foster carers?
Yes, I do think this part of the problem. It needs to be more established, like we should have some open days maybe where people can actually come and talk to people who've been fostering for years and people who've just come into fostering to hear exactly what you can and can't do. And a lot of people have got this thing that it's got to be, I was the same, I thought, you must have to be a married couple to be able to take on a child. But no, because when you look at it, there's a lot of single parent families out there and their children do get on just as well as living with both parents, you know.
So if you were going to recommend something to the government, what is it? It is about getting that message out there that it takes all types.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. That must be really highlighted. Doesn't matter about your culture, your marital status. Mm. You can still come on board this. And the government need to be pushing this more. Definitely.
And for you, it's just been a positive experience.
Absolutely. I've watched the child grow and get more. It's been amazing to see how the child is actually prospering and doing well and doing great. And